Support for Boston Public Radio comes from the Office of the Massachusetts State Treasurer. The Unclaimed Property Division is holding unclaimed funds from medical bills, uncashed paychecks, savings accounts, and more. To see if you have unclaimed money, you can visit findmassmoney.gov.
Today on Boston Public Radio, Monday's must-see TV has been put on hold. Christine Blasey Ford, who alleges that Brett Kavanaugh physically and sexually assaulted her, wants the FBI to investigate him before she participates in a Senate judiciary hearing. The Trump administration and Republicans' attitude to her, take it or leave it, this is widening a partisan divide. Are Democrats deliberately stalling in case they win back the Senate in November? Is the GOP recklessly rushing an abuser onto the court? And can getting to the truth ever be a nonpartisan pursuit and priority anymore? We'll open the lines and ask you.
September, as in now, marks the 10-year anniversary of the financial collapse. While the jury's still out on whether policymakers did enough at the time to keep it from being an even greater calamity, are they doing anything today to prevent another one? Harvard historian Nancy Kane joins us for that. At noon, Juliette Kime is here to go over the latest national security headlines. All that is next. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. So Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation hearing is no longer an examination of its character. It's an examination of our nation's character. And the latest twist, as I'm sure you know, Christine Blasey Ford, who's accused Kavanaugh of sexually assaulting her when they were teenagers, is not prepared to testify in a public hearing unless the FBI investigates her allegations first. In response, Senator Corker tweeted, quote, "Republicans extended a hand in good faith. If we don't hear from both sides on Monday, let's vote." And that tweet is largely representative of how the White House and other Senate Republicans feel. Against the backdrop of Me Too, we have Republicans provoking a woman who says she was nearly raped by the man they've chosen to serve on the highest court. And the GOP's put up or shut up attitude towards Ford is motivated by the midterm election and the court's next term, which, as I'm sure you know, begins in just a couple of weeks. So are we going to be a nation that puts politics and power ahead of justice? Even if you're a huge supporter of Brett Kavanaugh, wouldn't you rather delay the process until he gets the all clear? Wouldn't it be better for him to be fully vindicated? And even if you think the Democrats are politicizing justice, do their means justify the ends if we know once and for all who Brett Kavanaugh really is? The number is 877-301-8970. And one of the things I'm not clear about, it seems to me, even though they haven't said it, that on Monday, if she refuses to come because there's no FBI investigation ordered, that there may be a hearing anyway in which maybe someone reads the Washington Post out loud or something, the story, the interview she gave, and Kavanaugh gets to unequivocally deny everything that she alleges he did?
You know, having watched the, or not watched, reread the Anita Hill hearings yesterday with Clarence Thomas.
You did?
Yes. What you're impressed about is so how well-prepared and dignified she was, uh-huh. and how well-prepared he was. Kavanaugh has spent weeks and weeks practicing for his confirmation hearings. He spent hours these last few days at the White House going over his response to these accusations. This woman now, whose accusation just came public this week, she's had to move out of her house. She's had to get security for her family. She's living separate from her children mm-hmm. because of their fears and the death threats. Her email has been hacked. She's been impersonated on email. So I think going through that trauma of being eviscerated by these terrible people that have gone after her and having to, her whole life blown up, it may be difficult for her to come in on Monday morning with no preparation. And this is against a judge who's been preparing for hundreds and hundreds of hours.
So you think she's requesting the FBI investigation just to buy more time or because
well,
she
thinks? I think it's not really to buy more time. Well, I think there does need to be an investigation. And we need to bring in this Mark Judge character who is the person. And by the way, if you were going to make something up, I don't know if you'd have a second person in the room at the time.
If you tell a story in which it was
a
second person in the room.
And this Mark Judge character has got some very odd ideas, I think, about women, not just in his high school years, but in his grown-up years when he's written extensively about his feelings about masculinity and femininity and sexuality, the kind of perennial themes with him. Weird things. It's never occurred to me. Are disposable razors too feminine for men to use, Jim? You ever thought about that?
I failed to read that thing. Yeah. But can I get back to the FBI thing, if I may, just for a second? You know, while most people have discussed the politics of this, does it give a leg up to the Republicans? Because they could say on Monday, hey, she wanted to come testify. We said she could come testify. She chose not to. We can't let one person's allegations hold up the process. We read what she said. She had a forum. She chose to ignore the forum. All they really want to do, those Democrats, is delay until after the elections. But the side that I've not heard said at all, if she's allegedly making this up because Kavanaugh is such an upstanding person, why would she ever want the FBI to investigate? If I was making up a story, the last thing, what I would want to do is what she's invited to do, which is just tell my story and be questioned by antagonistic Republicans. The last thing I would want is a law enforcement agency investigating and being able to interview every single person I knew when I was 15 years old, when Kavanaugh was 17 years old. So if anything, even if there's some political motivation here, I think her demand through her lawyers that there be an FBI investigation first, if anything, buttresses her credibility.
Oh, I absolutely think it buttresses her credibility. And the other thing is that she's out of totally – here's the bottom line of this whole story, if you ask me. Clearly what's going on here is the Republicans want to get a conservative on the court before the midterm elections. They'll probably hold the Senate. Maybe they won't, but they probably will. But they're afraid that they won't. So they're willing to not delay, not have an investigation. Anita Hill said it best in the New York Times yesterday. The Senate doesn't know anything. I mean, their ignorance about sexual violence and sex harassment is indicated by Orrin Hatch, for just one example, who said that, you know, he believes Kavanaugh because he knows Kavanaugh. He doesn't know Ford, so he can't believe her. I mean, that's a really
enlightened... No, he also believes Kavanaugh because Kavanaugh said to him, I was never at that that place or at that time, even though Professor Ford has never said what the place or time was. And by the way, Hatch, since you read the Anita Hill transcripts yesterday, what did Hatch do and say in the Anita Hill
Hatch
hearing?
Hatch waved around a copy of The Exorcist and said that Anita Hill basically stole the notion of a pubic hair on a Coke can from a section of The
Exorcist. She plagiarized
Exorcist.
It. She made it up.
It is really... When you recall and what these guys said to her, asked her if she was if she was a scorned woman, asked her if she was fantasizing about these things, these gross things Clarence Thomas talked to her because she couldn't get a date, asked her if she wanted to be a martyr for the civil rights movement. I mean, it was so outrageous. We won't see that again the second time around. But the bottom line here is, we probably are not going to know what all the facts are. Which is not, because it happened a long time ago, and we're not going to probably get to the bottom of this. The question
FBI
is...
FBI would get us closer to the facts, in my estimation. That's
what
they do
and
for a living.
And we should have an investigation, as Hill says, because the Senate does not have the skills to do this kind of investigation, because they do not know enough about this corner of the law. But are we going to risk, when we don't know, putting... a second person on the United States Supreme Court for the rest of his life, credibly accused, in this case, of a sex crime, who's going to rule not only on Roe v. Wade, but maybe on shutting down Planned Parenthood and making it impossible for poor women and young women to get birth control, health care, and affordable exams. I mean, this is what we're going to do?
Well, you know,
I don't think
can we talk for 10 seconds about your favorite senator? And we'll get to the calls in a second. Susan Collins is getting a lot of heat. Mm-hmm. The question is, well, Bob Corker, who was one of the people who said, he's a retiring Republican, who said, I need to know, I need to hear from both sides. This is what he said a couple of days ago. He's now saying, we extended a hand in good faith. If we don't hear from both sides on Monday, let's just vote. Can Susan Collins do that? Can Lisa Murkowski, and someone yesterday, a caller said, why are you just mentioning the women? Well, because the women are the ones who have evinced most interest amongst the Republicans about women's issues, including choice. Can the women vote for him and say, hey, we got to vote for him? She chose not to show up because she had the nerve to say she wanted the FBI to investigate an attempted rape. I don't see how she does this. And keep in mind, the numbers are such. If the Democrats stay united, which is a real issue, but if the Democrats stay united, They need 50 of 51 Republican votes to get to the point where Mike Pence, as the president of the Senate and the vice president of the United States, cast the deciding vote. I think it's a really tough vote for these women, but we shall see. By the way, Trump was asked this on his way to the Carolinas today, was asked about whether the FBI should be involved. And he told reporters that FBI didn't seem interested in investigating the sexual assault allegations against Kavanaugh. Here's Trump and a reporter in the middle.
Well, it would seem that the FBI really doesn't do that. They've investigated about six times before, and it seems that they don't do that.
The reporter, the question you could barely hear that was yelled out, they would, meaning they would investigate if you asked them to, which obviously they would. And the fear on the part of the Republicans, I think this is a fact-based statement, the fear is if the FBI gets involved, that the likelihood of a confirmation vote would not happen until after the November elections. If it didn't happen until after the November elections, and in the small likelihood the Democrats took control of the Senate, while they wouldn't formally take office till January, it would be a real tough nut to crack for the Republicans to vote to confirm with a Republican-led Senate that was about to disappear as a majority in two months. So they want to get this in before November.
But as you just said a couple of minutes ago, that means that we're going to put politics ahead of any kind of justice. And we're going to rush ahead the appointment of a guy to the Supreme Court who will be on the Supreme Court for life.
And by the way, one last thing about what Marjorie's just saying. If those of you are listening and saying, well, Marjorie's convicting this guy right away, the FBI might come back and say there's no there. In which case, there's not a cloud, the same sort of cloud, hanging over Anthony Kennedy's replacement. And so wouldn't you want experts to be doing the analysis like Ford wants them to do? I think the answer is yes.
I'm saying it's not worth the risk. This is not, you're not appointing someone who's going to be the CEO of a company or even a president of a college or a principal of a school. You're appointing somebody to the United States Supreme Court. As Nancy Gertner
for life
has said, and many other people have said, no one's entitled to become a justice in the Supreme Court. Those people have to be above reproach. And we already have one guy on there who, to me, is a multiply incredibly accused sexual harasser.
That would be Clarence Thomas.
Right.
Maureen from Barry, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for your patience and welcome to the show. Hi.
Thank you both for your comments on this matter. It's extremely important one. And when one sees again what Anita Hill went through, I thank you people for continuing to bring this to the forefront and to have conversations about the fact that this man should be above reproach. And if it requires an investigation, and as you say, Jim, why would any woman, one, put themselves through this, or secondly, say, I am willing to have it investigated every little nook and cranny to demonstrate that I am, you know, I'm
telling
not
the truth, right?
And so I just thank you guys for bringing it forward and continuing the conversation about it, because I agree with you, Marjorie. He is going to get confirmed, and it is going to be a sadness for women in this country. Go ahead.
Martin, no, thank you. And thank you for calling and sharing your thoughts.
Yeah,
what
thank you, Maureen. Because you do kind of feel like that, and I don't mean to sound overly partisan, but the facts are fairly evident that the Republican Party is kind of out to get women who want to get birth control and who want to exercise their right to get an abortion. They're kind of out.
You're not partisan. We interviewed Donald Trump, the candidate in New Hampshire. We were the first people, I believe, to ask him if he had a litmus test for Supreme Court nominations. Yeah. He told us outright, they have to be really bright and they have to be pro-life, period.
Right.
I mean, there was no equivocation. He said it outright. Stephen Taunton, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Steve, thanks for calling in. Hi.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
A couple of points. One is I got a federal clearance years ago. I worked for a company that sold equipment to the government.
Yep.
So I said, my boss asked me, do you mind? I said, no problem. I really didn't care. And then my relatives started calling me. My friends started calling me saying, hey, I got a call from the FBI asking her. And I said, you're kidding me. Here's the point. If they do that to a bum like me, and Kavanaugh had multiple things done to him by the FBI, searches on him, something would have come out, all right? So, I mean, this notion that the FBI needs to go back in there on a crime 36 years ago, the woman can't recall where or when, is nonsense.
Wait a second. Why would this have come up if since he wouldn't have mentioned it, since Mark, a judge, wouldn't have mentioned it?
And she hadn't told anybody.
And she hadn't told anybody until her therapist, till 2012. Why would this come up in even the most thorough of FBI investigations until she went public?
Because he would have, the FBI would have asked his friends if there was any issues with him, anything like that, if they heard anything about him in high school, in grammar school, in college, in his personal life, I'll bet they tore him apart. And so I think something would have come out indicative of his character that, by all accounts, didn't exist after that. So there's no narrative to that. There's no follow-up. He was a stellar person for years afterwards, so it was completely against his a character. My second point is, it really bothered me yesterday. I couldn't chime in. I was busy.
Okay.
But it really bothered me to hear you guys say, because you guys are normally, you're partisan a lot of times, but you're fair, all right, to say that Kavanaugh has to prove that he is innocent.
I said that.
Yeah, that is ridiculous. That is completely against what we are as a people.
Well, you know, Steve, as I said when I said what I said, and you're right, I did say that the burden of proof should not be on her to prove, and obviously it's not a criminal case, beyond a reasonable doubt. Didn't mean that literally. It should be on him to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he didn't do it. It's because of what Marjorie and I have been saying. This is unlike any other job in the world. It's not like the job you were applying for. It's not like whatever check was done on me and Marjorie before we hired at GBH. It is the single most powerful appointed job for a lifetime in the United States of America. Special rules should apply. And so I accept your criticism, but I feel exactly the same way today that I did yesterday. Steve, thank you, as always, for your calls.
And
we appreciate it.
And again, and Steve's a great caller, but I disagree with the premise. If she didn't tell anybody, Kavanaugh didn't tell anybody, Mark Judge, the other guy in the room who's written two books talking about how he had blackouts and couldn't remember whole sections of his life, didn't tell anybody, which friend would have reported this? Who would have even known? So I disagree with that premise. And again, that is something that is so consistent with these stories over the years. And we go back to the priest, which is one of the best examples ever.
Yeah, by the way, also, we shouldn't assume this thing is over, by the way. Monday is the scheduled hearing, meaning who knows what's going to happen between now and Monday. Not to mention, remember the other day when the morning started, Chuck Grassley, the chair of the committee, was saying all they're going to be are phone interviews with Kavanaugh and Ford. Hours later, Trump was saying, let's slow down the process. And by the end of the day, there was a hearing scheduled. So it's Thursday. No, it's not. Is it Wednesday? It's Wednesday.
It is Wednesday today, Jim.
Who knows what Monday will bring?
If we're talking about the latest twist in the Brett Kavanaugh saga, asking you if the FBI should investigate him before the Senate moves to a vote, that conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And if you're just tuning in, we're talking about the latest developments in the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation process, asking you if he should be fully vetted by the FBI before the Senate holds a hearing. Should he and Christine Blasey Ford, who has accused Kavanaugh of sexually assaulting when they were teens, not participate in a public hearing before that happens? Or are the Republicans right? She's invited on Monday. They are willing to listen to them. And as Senator Corker from Tennessee says, after Monday happens, if she chooses not to show up, let's just vote. You know, I'm sure you've heard this a lot in the last 24 hours, and I'm sure Brett Kavanaugh regrets joking. And he said it with a smile on his face. He was talking about his time at Georgetown Prep, which is when this allegedly happened, when he's giving a speech at Catholic University's Columbus School of Law. This was in 2015 in D.C., and here is what he said. And again, you won't see him, but he says it with a smile on his face. He's joking, essentially, I think you could fairly say. Here he is.
Fortunately, we had a good saying that we've held firm to this day, as the dean was reminding me before before the talk, which is what happens at Georgetown Prep stays at Georgetown Prep. That's been a good thing for all of us, I think.
Well, draw your own conclusions. 877-301-8970.
He did it again, too, talking about Yale Law School, talking about nights of heavy drinking and describing taking a bus with his classmates to Boston Red Sox game, a night of bar hopping, ended with students falling out of the bus onto the front steps of Yale Law School at 4:45 a.m. And fortunately for all of us, he said, we need a motto then, too. What happens on the bus stays on the bus. So that's a recurring theme, I guess, of Judge Kavanaugh.
877-301-8970. So we're mostly talking about the implications of her demand, Professor Ford's demand, that there not be a hearing on Judge Kavanaugh, further hearing on Judge Kavanaugh on her accusations until the FBI has done an investigation. The president and the Republicans on the committee seem to be saying no deal. Brendan, you're in a car. You're on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling in. Hi.
Hey, Jim and Marjorie. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
So I just want to make two quick points. I think, number one, absolutely the FBI should investigate this accusation. Number two, I don't think even if they were to confirm that Judge Kavanaugh is a serial killer, that is going to stop the GOP trying to push through his nomination. And I hate to be cynical about that, but this has been the crown jewel of the Republican Party for over 40 years. They know that they're not the majority in this country. And so the Supreme Court serves for life. That is where their game is right now.
And it's smart. Would you not agree? I mean, it might not be terribly democratic, but it is a smart game plan, no?
It is. And I wish the Democrats spend more time talking about it. In fact, if you look at the 2016 exit polling, Democrats compared to Republicans, Supreme Court wasn't even in the top five for most Democrats.
Well, Brendan, if I can pat Marjorie and me on the back, one place where you heard pretty repeatedly prior to the November vote in 2016 that there's virtually nothing more important that a president does other than maybe declare war than who he or she picks to be on the Supreme Court. You heard it here. It's huge, and it's obviously playing out. And by the way, Brendan, thanks for the call. People should keep in mind, this is pick number two on the part of Donald Trump. He's got, in his first term, 2 years and, what, 2 or 3 months left. There's some very old people on the Supreme Court who are liberals for the most part.
Yeah.
There's Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Is that cancer twice? Twice? She's in her mid-80s.
Yep.
Steve Breyer from across the river in Cambridge is 80 years old, a liberal judge.
There's 79.
I think I said that, and then one of our coworkers said he just turned 80.
Okay.
But whatever it is, he's 79 or 80. There are two more years, and I wish them health, like I wish everybody, obviously, not everybody, most people, good health. There's a decent shot the president of the United States could end up picking four people in their 50s who could serve 35 years on the Supreme Court.
It's important to consider what a lot of their positions would lead them to rule on. They're not for workers' rights, not for consumer rights, not for in favor of deregulation.
Rights, affirmative
civil
action.
Rights,
look
exactly
at what Anthony Kennedy was the fifth vote on, and you can pretty much see, even with the appointment of Kavanaugh, even if you believe he's a stellar, decent person, what the consequence, as you know, Barack Obama said, elections have consequences. And I hope people, the ideology, Trump should be able to pick one as long as he or she is not wildly out of the mainstream. And at least until this thing came up, obviously there were enough votes, I think, for his confirmation, despite sketchy answers on a bunch of things.
This court for 20, 30 years could have an enormous impact on your ability to live your life the way you want to.
Right. 6, 7, 8 presidential elections. Ann in Grafton, you've been patient, too. Thanks so much for calling. Hi.
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 I just have a couple thoughts.
Sure.
I'm the mother of a rape survivor.
Oh,
and one thing that this whole group is missing is, you know, all the nuances about sexual assault. Number one, I think, Marjorie, you said that. So, you know, we're expecting, you know, people like Chuck Grassley to get this issue. He's not.
Right.
I think 10 years from now, after 10 years after the Me Too movement, we might have a better shot at looking at this in a proper light. Other than trying to keep the bile down from watching this process, I'm trying to be objective. And, you know, it just looks like one more, you know, example of institutional oppression of women. Really, by this, you know, with just not taking the time. I get there's a rush to get this guy confirmed. I get the whole politics of it. But it is totally politics over justice and shame on the women that vote. Shame on the women that vote that won't give it the proper time. I don't care, I don't agree with the Republicans. I'm a Democrat, whatever. But you know what? This process is really wrong. And it is denying a woman who possibly has gone through something her day in court, really.
Yeah.
And you know, the Brett Kavanaughs of the world, they are bred from 18 years old on. My daughter's rapist was a serial rapist by admission of students at the campus and graduated honors, star, you name it. I don't know where in the world he is, but I'll bet he's going to be up for something really big, and it's going to make us all go, holy crap. But if she came forward 30 years from now and went after him again because nobody listened to her when she was in college, you know, would it be in the same situation? So I think the FBI needs to investigate it. We need every stone unturned. And that doesn't mean I believe every woman or my big thing, and I won't go on, but my daughter and I, we've talked in the area at high schools and stuff. You know, there's regrettable sex and then there's rape.
Right.
And we're getting it all mixed up. And we're getting, and in the midst of the Me Too movement, it's getting very mucky. So nobody really wants to parse it all out. But this process, this is one of the most important places in the United States. But then my last comment, we have a serial sexual predator leading us all. So what do we do with that?
Anne, thanks for sharing your story and your daughter's.
Yeah, Anne, thank you very much. And it is so true that rape is an extremely difficult crime to get a conviction on. The vast majority of people don't even go to the authorities over this. There are all sorts of rapists running around America who will never be brought to task for their crimes. I mean, it's just
unless Ronan Farrow works late.
And we know that most of the people that get accused of these things, whether it's sexual harassment or just they'll deny it. I mean, some of them have said that they did something. Most of them have said they didn't do anything. Bill O'Reilly said he didn't do anything. Bill Cosby said he didn't do anything. I mean, how many women accused Bill Cosby?
80, 70, something.
He didn't do anything. Yeah. He just keeps denying over and over again.
You know what that caller reminded me of, which may sound as naive as it turned out to be? If you had said to me 3 months ago or whenever, Kavanaugh was nominated in July, that at some point in this process there's going to be an accusation of attempted rape by somebody. It's in the middle of the Me Too era. Can you imagine the Republican majority not agreeing to a thorough investigation, even if they vote yes at the end of the day? I would have said there's not one chance in a million in this era that 51 Republicans, including Murkowski and Collins, can say, well, they haven't said this yet, by the way, but if they vote yes, they have. Oh, we don't have time for an FBI investigation of a charge that on its face, while surely not proven, is surely not incredible. I would have said in this era, it is impossible that will happen. So while the consensus is the Republicans, including those who are still there from Anita Hill, like Orrin Hatch, are not going to behave towards Ford, should she appear like they behave towards Anita Hill, the ultimate behavior is the process, how they rule on the process. And if their position is we don't have time for a full investigation, then they're basically as bad as those who decided that Anita Hill and we should say one more thing in the spirit of candor. Joe Biden, the Democrat who probably wants to be president, was as much of a problem in the Anita Hill hearing as the Republicans were. He essentially cowered in the corner and refused to allow four women to testify whose testimony apparently would have corroborated Anita Hill. So, you know, it's not just the Orrin Hatches with the pubic hair abomination and others like him talking about erotomania or whatever it is they talked about in the Anita Hill hearing. It was the Democrat who chaired the committee. Democrats controlled the Senate then, who essentially made it impossible for Anita Hill to prove her case.
And one last thing I want to say before we get back to the calls. The scenario she points to is
Ford?
that two 17-year-old guys who have talked all the time in high school about getting sauced, getting drunk. I mean, Kavanaugh's made jokes about this. This guy, Mark Judge, who she says, and again, if you're making up a story, you probably don't want to say there were two people in the room, but she has.
Because Judge theoretically would corroborate the defense of Kavanaugh, his friend.
Right. And this Judge guy, who does not sound like a very nice character to me, in high school, and we can forgive him this, I suppose, because it was in high school when he had in his yearbook, where the hell were his parents, that certain women should be struck regularly like gongs. That's what he said in high school.
Quoting Noel Coward.
But later on, when he talks about rape, he's sobered up now after he wrote his book about Wasted, mm-hmm. about how he was a Gen X drunk and how he couldn't remember half his life because he blacked out all the time, which would be my theory about maybe he blacked out at the time he was supposedly laughing forgot about when he was supposedly laughing, according to Ford, when Kavanaugh was attempting to rape her. This is what he wrote as an adult, a grown-up, sober, no longer drinking adult, about rape. He does concede, thank God, that there is no excuse to rape anybody. He says it's almost akin to murder. This is a quote from him. And yet, what women wear and their body language also sends signals about their sexuality. So what he is in essence saying there is that women can sometimes invite rape
Bring
by what
on.
They wear, which is something that we have debunked since the 1960s, 70s at least.
Let's take one or two more quick ones if we can. Let's go to Jack in Gloucester. You're on Boston Public Radio. Thank you much for calling. Hi, Jack.
Hello. Yes, I'm very glad. I'm very glad that you've taken my call.
Sure.
And that book, God and Man at Georgetown Prep, is an unbelievable tell-all book.
This is Mark Judge as well, yeah.
Yeah, I was reading sections of that last night when they talked about just this climate of just debauchery and heavy drinking and not very enlightened attitudes about women, et cetera. You're right, Jack. That's the second book.
That's the second book. The first one, Wasted, was also a tell-all book about being drunk most of the time at Georgetown Prep. So the question for me is, why wouldn't the FBI want to investigate this, that this guy was supposedly the witness, that the FBI should go talk to him, talk to the other people at the party? At the party, in the book, he says they took pictures of all the guys falling drunk into the swimming pool, that there were pictures. There could be pictures
that I did not
somewhere.
Know, Jack.
Says that in the book?
That I did not know.
That's in the book.
Well, you know, Jack, you know, obviously if it was an investigation, wouldn't it just be Mark Judge who would be interviewed? I assume classmates of both of these people would be, well, all three of them actually would be interviewed. That's the whole point of an investigation, to attempt to get to the truth. So I am totally with you, and I think fair-minded people, even if they love Judge Kavanaugh, would want him to be cleared if they think he's clean, too. Jack, thank you for the call.
Yeah, just a couple more quick things about this Mark Judge character, that he briefly went back to Georgetown University, which is a college, of course, not the prep school, to teach. He didn't like it, though. And one of the reasons he didn't like it, because he said, and he went on to become a conservative commentator. I saw course descriptions requiring students to read comic books and watch the feminist film Thelma and Louise. He didn't like that. And he didn't like the fact that there were academic papers that were saying great things about women's studies or African-American studies. He also, as I said before, this is a new one on me, wrote that disposable razors are too feminine for men to use.
Yeah, you said that a couple of times.
And that former President Barack Obama is practically a woman. I hadn't heard that either.
Well, he obviously knows something we don't.
He has certain themes that have carried past high school way into his adulthood, which are a little different, if you ask me.
We have time for just one more. John and Gardner, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Take it away.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
Thanks. Jim, and not only about – I was shocked. I saw a several-minute clip of Biden questioning Anita Hill.
Mm-hmm.
I was shocked at how much he was asking graphic – detail-oriented questions. I was shocked.
I think he disgraced himself. And by the way, while he is Anita Hill has said an apology is deserved she deserves one from him. He has not yet given it to her directly.
He's
never said
directly.
It to her directly. Yeah. Go ahead,
John. You know what? The only thing they're really going to be able to focus on, and you know I'm an alky, but a lot of us did episodic binge drinking when we were kids.
Yeah.
And a lot of us got into blackouts, not just alkies like me. A lot of people I know that weren't alkies went through some of that. Anyway, if drinking is focused on, and it comes out that he did any of this episodic binge drinking, like the, what's his name, Judge?
Yeah,
Mark Judge.
Judge just talked about, how can he then deny anything? Because we all know we don't remember anything and everything during a blackout. And I got something Ann said on her good call. Do you think that there's, I think, two or three other, Joni Ernst and Debbie Fisher, and I think there's another woman in the that's a Republican in the Senate. Is there any chance of a dark horse woman senator other than the, you know, the pro-choice Joyce folks that we already know about that might step up?
Why don't you? How about Jeff Flake, a man from Arizona? How about Ben Sasse from Nebraska? Obviously, Corker has decided he's not going to step up vis-a-vis the FBI investigation. As the woman who called yesterday, she didn't criticize me, but she said, well, maybe she did. Why you only mention the Republican women? Theoretically, there should be men of principle who believe in process and justice,
or
too,
who aren't,
even if as of the moment they think Judge Kavanaugh should be confirmed. So maybe they are. John, thanks
or
for the call.
Who aren't hostile to women.
Yeah.
I mean, taking
away the
ability to get cancer screenings, pap test, STD screenings from poor women who can't get it elsewhere because they can't afford it. And we all know the Republicans have gutted Obamacare, or practically gutted Obamacare, is sort of hostile to women. Why does Trump want to take away women's ability to get STDs at a local clinic that's affordable?
Well, by the way, I said the other day, I don't know if it's here on the radio or on television, the ABC Washington Post most recent poll on the generic congressional ballot shows on would you vote for a Democrat or an unnamed Democrat or a Republican? While there's a 10-point margin for the Democrats overall, the margin amongst women voters is 58% Democratic, 33% Republican I think that very reason.
Well, because we'd all like to know if we if we have cancer, or we'd all like to be able to get birth control, especially when you're young and you don't have any money and Planned Parenthood is the only place to go, and in very many cases it is the only place to go. Anyway, we are moving on. It has been 10 years since the global financial collapse, and Washington is busy dismantling the infrastructure put in place to prevent another one. Why are we refusing to learn from the past? Harvard historian Nancy Cain joins us for that. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. This month marks the 10th anniversary of our financial system buckling under the weight of big lending. It set off the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, with millions of Americans losing their homes, their jobs, their savings.
What in the world is happening on Wall Street?
The Dow traders are standing there watching in amazement, and I don't blame them.
From the financial capital of the world, the opening bell is going to ring in 5 seconds, and to be honest with you, we wish it wouldn't.
Traders here working the phone say a lot of their customers are freaked out, waiting to see how low the Dow will go. They're focused on the
life as most Americans know it is about to change, in some cases dramatically.
Buddy, can you spare a dime?
Well, the debate is still going on as to whether policymakers did enough to prevent the meltdown from being even worse, or are policymakers doing enough right now to keep another crisis from happening? Joining us for her take on this is Harvard historian Nancy Cain. Nancy holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration at the Harvard Business School. Her latest book is Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. Hello, Nancy Cain.
Hey there.
So, Nancy Cain, it seems to me that we have not done nearly enough. In fact, we're going backwards. Am I right or wrong?
I think that's overall, I think that's right. And for those of folks who are interested in this specific aspect, or how vulnerable is the American economy and our polity to another financial crisis, you might take a look at Elizabeth Warren's op-ed piece in the Globe dated September 14th this year. 10 years after Lehman collapsed, Washington was back to its old tricks. And if you're not a fan of Elizabeth Warren, or you worry about her statistics, they're sound, I tell you. They're not political numbers. If you want another option, The Real Cost of the 2008 Financial Crisis by John Cassidy in The New Yorker. And that date is, I don't have it, but it's the last 2 weeks of The New Yorker. So, yes, we are vulnerable again. We are vulnerable because some of the things that got the world economy, it wasn't an American financial crisis, it was a global financial crisis, and the rise of right-wing leaders and their popularity is direct in all kinds of places, is Italy, Eastern Europe, the United States, is directly traceable at some very important levels to the financial crisis in those places as well as here. The same things that got our economy into some of, and the world economy into this terrible moment, which from which most Americans have not yet recovered financially, not to mention emotionally or socially, are still in place. That is, the banks are we now have a fewer number of banks. They are more tightly interconnected. The things, the guardrails that were enacted after the financial crisis to prevent another financial crisis have gradually overall been weakened. That's things like the Dodd-Frank legislation, or more important, the Volcker rule, which is about what banks can do in terms of trading with the funds they take in, have been weakened. And at the same time, you know, the world economy is sloshing around in debt, in large amounts of debt all over the place, both at public and at private levels, in the private economy as well as in the governmental economies. And so we have a moment when – and we have, by the way, a Federal Reserve System and an administration that does not necessarily have the same will – to do the kind of triage. It was an emergency room triage with the crash cart on the global on a number of big, huge banks.
The bailout, you mean? The
bailout, mm-hmm, that prevented it from getting even worse. I don't think that was nearly enough. I'm now absolutely convinced of that. It was not nearly enough, but it was a necessary condition. It was not sufficient, but it was necessary in order to prevent something much, much worse, the nuclear power plant imploding, so to speak, the nuclear power plant of the world economy.
You know, one of the best stories I wrote about this was also in our preparation for you today was this M.H. Miller. He doesn't say what his first name is, who's an editor at the New York Times.
This is phenomenal.
So you figure he's probably, I would guess, making $90,000, maybe $100,000. So he's making a good salary. But he talks about how he came of age during the 2008 financial crisis, and he's still angry about it because his parents refinanced their home to help him pay for college.
At NYU, dear
listeners. And the bottom fell
out. Yeah.
They were foreclosed upon. They couldn't find jobs after the recession. But he talks about...
And they have huge amounts of debt, right?
Huge amounts of debt. But he talks about that they have been dutifully, and he has been dutifully as well, making his payments on his student loans. But he's not getting anywhere, and he's paying them to Citigroup, which is one of the banks that got the biggest bailouts in the 2008. When they bailed out the banks,
now enjoying record profits, dear listeners.
And he now owes more than when he started out owing them, which it seems incredible to me. But that's what he says. And his parents, I think his parents lost.
Sounds
their house.
Like his parents lost their home.
Yes.
Yeah, so this is
middle-class parents, by the way.
Middle-class parents. This is a really powerful article, dear listeners. I came of age during the 2008 financial crisis. I'm still angry about it. M.H. Miller, September 15th in the New York Times. And it is very, very powerful. He's arguing not only that financially, economically, his parents haven't recovered. And just – I went back and did a little homework here on this just for rough numbers. About $17 trillion, that's in real inflation-adjusted dollars, of household worth. That's the average worth of total worth of all American households, all 100-plus million of them. That declined between 2007 and 2010, $17 trillion. That's about a quarter, 26%. That meant in average terms, median terms, that the median wealth of a household went from $126,000 to $77,000 between 2007 and 2010. So there are lots and lots of people that have not recovered that amount. You know, that's $60,000. There are many, many people who have given up looking for work, so they're not captured in record unemployment low rates. There are many, many people who still don't have anything like what they had before the crisis. So he's saying that happened financially, but emotionally, this has been so tremendously difficult for not just his parents' generation, the millennial generation, all of whom were thought they'll get a good education, they'll go out, they'll get a job, and they'll be able to buy a house and have the kind of lifestyle that their parents had, and they don't have a prayer. They don't have a prayer because of student debt. You know, he's paying more now than he was because of ballooning interest on the debt. They don't have a prayer because the job market is so different, and they don't have a prayer because of the rising healthcare costs and rising housing costs. So It's a really profound short piece about the widespread effects, consequences of this pivotal incident, the 2008 financial crisis.
You know, I look at it an additional or a different way. A lot of people are focusing, as they, I guess they should, on this anti-regulatory environment, less federal scrutiny of banks up to, what was the new threshold, $250 billion or whatever it is. It seems to me that something that was not done in the past is the greatest concern. We've discussed ad nauseum through the years, you and I, Marjorie, as is everybody else, what one mid-level person ever prosecuted because of the crimes.
Right.
The best documentary that was nominated for Academy Award, in my opinion, should have won, by Frontline, Abacus, was the story of the only bank in America that was indicted for mortgage fraud relating to the 2008 financial crisis, a family-owned bank, a Chinese family in Chinatown in New York City. I hope I get the number right. It's close to this. The 2,651st largest bank. When the message is the worst that happens is you're going to be outed, but don't worry. There are no orange jumpsuits in your executive futures. Mm-hmm. There is no prosecution that's going to be directed as long as you cozy up to
exactly.
the district attorney of Manhattan in this case. That, to me, is as scary going forward as the anti-regulatory mindset of Washington and the Trump administration.
On Obama, by the way. I mean, that was
you bet that. You bet that's on Barack Obama's shoulders.
On Barack Obama.
And I could not agree more. And there was an interesting article for those of you that want to follow this thread that Jim is mentioning in The Guardian, the English newspaper, called Where Are They Now? The Key Figures in the Financial Crisis. It's dated September 11th, 2018. Lehman Brothers Collapse. Where Are the Key Figures Now? And it goes on to say, show you that people like Richard Dick Fuld, the head of Lehman Brothers, Ben Bernanke, right, who was very
important, yeah.
Henry Hank Paulson, who was Secretary of the Treasury under Bush, Tim Geithner, who went on to be secretary, almost all of these folks, well, are working in some ways for big banks or large financial institutions.
Why leave Jamie Dimon from J.P. Morgan Chase?
Yes.
Is thinking of running for president of the United States.
Because he's smarter than Donald Trump. Right,
that's
because
what he said.
Right.
And Obama invited him to one of the state.
No, Lloyd Blankfein
was at the first state dinner. I'm
Lloyd
sorry.
Blankfein exactly. from Goldman Sachs, I'll never forget the image,
never.
Was at the first state dinner. It was for the president of China that Barack Obama had when he took over the White House.
Right, so you do the kind of emotional arithmetic here, right, dear listeners, all of us. These are people who are richer now, right, fatter and happier than they were before they presided over institutions that allowed, right, that created the instruments around, and this is not to take anything away from the culpability of people buying mortgages, taking out mortgages they can't afford, but this is to go to the top of the chain and say what really mm-hmm. at the top made this happen? The rating agencies that said these lousy financial instruments were A-type investable grade securities. The folks at the top, no one was punished, not a soul. And then let's fast forward to Trump's last campaign ad. His last campaign ad, then the pieces really start to get interesting. It's a television ad. It showed headshots. I'm reading from the New Yorker article by John Cassidy, dear listeners. Headshots of Janet Yellen, the chair of the Federal Reserve at the time, Lloyd Blankfein, the chief executive of Goldman Sachs, while Trump, in an alarmist voiceover, warned, I quote you, that a global power structure, unquote, had made decisions that, quote, robbed a handful of large corporations, that robbed our working class, stripped our economy of its wealth, and put that money into the pockets of a handful of large corporations and public entities.
Well, he ran as a populist. I mean, he was going to save the forgotten man.
Right.
But they haven't done that, obviously. And,
forgotten
and,
women, too, by the way.
Oh, no. And when we had the big Christmas gift of the tax break that gave all these folks more, all these people at the top and these big companies, the big banks,
right.
more.
But the thing, so, okay, the Trump administration has tried to roll back parts of Dodd-Frank. Mm-hmm. So is the motivation just to make more money for their friends in the cabinet that are millionaires? Or is this just we don't like regulation? Or what's going on?
So I think this is primarily a political issue. I don't think there's a lot of substance here. I think this is about a lot of folks in Washington, some elected, some in positions in regulatory agencies and in the administration, some of whom have come out of the banking industry, some of whom are going back into the banking industry. I think this is about he who has the gold makes the rules. That's what I think is really going on with the watering down, despite warnings by all kinds of smart economists and others that this should not be happening, and that this is really dangerous for everyone. I think that's what's going on. I think it is primarily about access and influence and money. One last thing I really have to, I feel kind of honor bound to say, and that is that in some other sense, if we go back to a sense of anger and frustration and this wonderful line that our writer, Mr. Miller, uses, if this was the defining trauma of my generation and the connective tissue of a demographic like mine, there is also a simmering populist rage that is spreading and seeping and still living very, very healthily among lots and lots of us. If we think of all that, we also have to say that that the massive amount of income and wealth inequality that was in place before and growing before the financial crisis has grown more rapidly.
Yeah, it's worse.
Has grown more rapidly since the financial crisis. So you add all those different pieces up, or put them all together that we're talking about, from the different people involved that weren't punished, to what that meant to most people around the world, average people around the world, to what's emerging politically, partly out of this kind of terrain. You add all that up, and it is not a very stable picture. It is not a very optimistic, and boy, this looks like a kind of justice and democratic equilibrium is going to emerge. So I think it's really important to remember we're really poking a bear, and it's a really terrible bear called inequality that's growing rapidly.
You know, we just saw that Frontline piece about Dayton, Ohio, and it looks like something bombed out in the after World War II. And yes, before we go, I wanted to ask you, because you're a big fan of the BSO, I know, too. Tell the great story.
Oh, did you see the great story?
By
BSO. The way, we only have 30 seconds
yeah, you
here,
tell.
But you're a big supporter, both yeah. of us, Marjorie and I.
Huge supporter.
Love the BSO. There's a great story in the Globe, if you haven't seen it, about how they almost didn't make it to their last concert on their European trip because the plane malfunctioned. They could only essentially send, 60% of the orchestra to Amsterdam. Andres Nelson changes the program on the spot with no rehearsal. It's almost like an adventure story, not to mention about an institution that all three of us love. Read this thing. It's called A Scramble Then Ovations as BSO salvages its European tour finale. And by the way, when Andres Nelson gets back to Boston, we're going to have him in to talk about that and everything else. It's a great story.
Thank you so much, Nancy Kane, who joins us every week. She holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration at the Harvard Business School. Her latest book is Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. Up next, Juliette Kayyem on Kavanaugh, the hurricanes, and more. She's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
At noon on Boston Public Radio, President Trump is after the FBI again, renewing his claims that the agency spied on his campaign, and his proof he's declassified Russia documents that will supposedly prove wrongdoing. Is Trump trying to discredit the FBI now that it could actually investigate his Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh? The last national security expert, Juliette Kayyem, about this and more.
The new president of Planned Parenthood, unlike her predecessor, Cecile Richards, practices medicine, not politics. As a physician, could she help reorient the organization as a healthcare clinic for women, rather than, as pro-lifers like to frame it, an abortion clinic? Our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan, joins us for that and more. Then we wrap things up with another edition, Can't Wait, with naturalist Cy Montgomery, here with tales from the animal kingdom, from daredevil squirrels to impudent seagulls to goats born with the equivalent of facial recognition software. All that is next on Boston Public Radio.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello again, Jim. What are you laughing at?
We all had to rush to digest the cookies and cake that Nancy baked and brought, and all three of us, like losers, are stuffing this.
Wait, she baked those?
Yeah. I don't know if she actually bakes them. But she brings them.
Her infrastructure.
Yeah. I need an infrastructure like that.
Yes,
and they
you
got
do.
The, those coconut things.
Okay, I made a kugel chocolate. This morning. I'm going to bake it this afternoon for Happy Yom Kippur.
Well, I love kugel. Bring that right in.
Okay, so the Trump administration on the eve of hurricane season diverted $10 million from FEMA to fund ICE. While communities are still recovering from last year's storms, the Trump administration decided to siphon off money that would normally fund FEMA's, quote, it's called preparedness and protection efforts and response and recovery programs to supplement ICE's detention beds and transportation and removal programs. What are we to make of a government that prioritizes perceived threats, in this case migrants crossing the border, over actual disasters that, as you all know, have already resulted in the deaths of at least 37 people by my count? Joining us for a take on this and other national security headlines is Juliette Kayyem. Juliette's on the faculty of Harvard's Kennedy School. She's an analyst for CNN and the CEO of Zimcar. Hi, Juliette Kayyem.
Nice to see you both.
You too.
In person.
So, Juliette, before we even get to the $10 million that's supposedly been siphoned off, how are they doing? How is FEMA doing? I saw Brock Long on TV over the weekend. He seems to know what he's talking about.
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, well, there's two answers to that question. The first is operationally in light of Florence. So far, we haven't seen the extent of the damage yet. I mean, they are still in the throes of flooding. Obviously, the hurricane downgraded by the time it hit. But, you know, as Jim was saying, you know, over three dozen dead is not insignificant. And so what you're seeing, and I think it was really good state and local leadership across the board in North Carolina in particular. So you're seeing sort of, the continuing kumbaya that will, you know, resources will be driven. I think the bigger question is going to be issues like long-term damage, claims processes. That's always the hard part. But we're not done yet. I mean, this flooding is just absolutely incredible. And then when the waters finally recede, you know, what does the property look like? Are you going to let people, you know, continue to build there? How are you going to rebuild? Those are the bigger questions, which always end up being political. The second part of my answer is, how is FEMA doing? As many have read, Brock Long, the head of FEMA, is under investigation at this stage now for behavior that just, is just so bizarre for those of us who knew him before he went on board. You know, there's a tendency for critics of the Trump administration to say, you know, anyone who works for him is horrible. There's evidence that a lot of people who work for him are corrupt. But Brock Long was a subject matter expert. He was someone who came
in. You know
him? Yeah. So he was someone who came in, not well, but I mean, the world is small, but, you know, definitely got to know him over the years in emergency management and disaster management. That's his background. And was just viewed as sort of one of those competent picks in the throw, you know, in an agency that needed competency. So this behavior where essentially he never moved his family and basically used government resources.
And he drove the government cars
back and forth. And
yeah.
It's just, you know, the kind of thing that gets you into trouble. And because a number of people have a bullseye on his back, including probably the Secretary of Homeland Security, Nielsen. I don't think Brock Long will be. I think we'll get out of Florence and Brock Long will resign.
We don't know yet that he's required any staff person to go get him a used bed from the Trump Hotel.
No, not yet. We're not at, or soap, or special soaps.
Hold on.
Across
the
board.
What's that?
Just why does Nielsen have
Oh, because it's a snake pit everywhere
snake pit.
I mean, I think she has someone who she wants to run. I mean, wants to run FEMA. And also, you know, I think Brock Long is sort of a perfect example of you know, Rick Wilson, this commentator whose, you know, line is everything Trump touches dies, I think, which is just a way of thinking that once you're in, it's hard to sort of keep yourself from getting, you know, diffused into the madness of Trump. I mean, here's Brock Long, who's now in a corruption investigation. He's someone who, you know, when he says on TV, well, he has said on TV he questions the Puerto Rico numbers. You know he does not deep down inside believe that.
He's protecting the president.
He's protecting the president. And so now you have the head of FEMA.
Well, that was an audience of one kind of interview.
And that's what ends up happening with everyone around Trump, unless you get out.
Can I get off this and get back? I mean, the way I started this was about the diversion of this $10 million into, you know, capture and whatever they were doing with migrants. You know, we violated a pledge, Marjorie and I, inadvertently, we made to a listener about a month ago, who said you should say something about the kids who were still separated from their parents
every day.
Every single day. We did. I guess we went on vacation. We forgot for a few days. And there's still hundreds who mm-hmm. are separated. But then I woke up this morning to an email that Marjorie had sent me forwarding a New York Times article. Here's the headline. U.S. loses track of another 1,500 migrant children. Here's the first paragraph of this Ron Nixon story in today's Times. The Trump administration is unable to account for the whereabouts of nearly 1,500 migrant children who illegally entered the United States alone this year and were placed with sponsors after leaving federal shelters. In findings that lawmakers described as troubling, really, Senate investigators said the department could not determine with certainty the whereabouts of 1,488 out of 11,254 children, that's 12% roughly, the agency had placed with sponsors in 2018 based on follow-up calls, et cetera. And they said the same roughly the same numbers last year. Then they go on to say, well, the law is such that once they leave the shelters, yes. they're no longer our responsibility. This is, you know, talk about legalisms yeah. and amorality. This is, and this is separate from the separation yes. of parents. We should just be clear. 1,500 migrant children are, quote, lost, which yeah. is a euphemism. What's your reaction to this
so
thing?
It's, I mean, I'm absolutely horrified. And just to explain this, so this is, of course, as Jim was describing, the pool of kids who come here with no parents. So this is not the family separation issue, which is itself in and of itself horrifying. So that these kids are here without guardian protection. So what HHS does is it tries to find sponsors. Most of the time it's family members. So that's good news. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's foster parents. And none of it, I think, is in public services like or, you know, orphan or foster care. The sponsors are sort of reviewed for 30 days, right? Do they have a criminal background, you know, sexual misconduct, whatever else? But then after 30 days, they are the kids are viewed as within the guardianship of these sponsors. So the problem is that when HHS goes to determine where these kids are, these follow-up phone calls, about 1,500 of the families are not responding. So that's different than saying that they're lost. So I think the headline
I think they're
is
lost till they're found. Exactly. Well, I would say.
So right. So you would think that HHS 1,500 is not a huge pool. You divide up by 100 caseworkers, and that's 150. You know, whatever you do, and you just go visit. You make sure that the kid's okay. There's probably reasons why the families are not calling back. They may have immigration status issues. They may be worried that the kid is going to be taken away.
They may be human traffickers.
At
too.
This stage, that's what your worry is now. Is that some percentage, even if it's 1%, are no longer with the sponsors, or that the sponsors have not been adequate sponsors, and because they're not wards of the government any longer. There's just no requirement to determine what's happened to them. So the fact that the federal government is resigned under, as you say, legalese to let those 1,500 just be assumed lost, even though, you know, there may be a good news story out of this, right? And you would want the government to know that, you know, 100% are still with their sponsors. But why no one's taking responsibility of it is consistent with the other part, which is when they separated the children and with the parents, and no one seems to feel responsible for the well-being of children who are either coming here alone under horrible circumstances or being separated by their parents. At this stage, on the family separation issue, the second issue, the fact that there is not 100% family unification is absolutely outrageous at this stage.
Still because, between 400 and 500.
Right. And,
I looked
and,
up last right, night.
Some
and,
of them younger than five.
Yeah. yeah. This, as I say, this is a manageable pool. This is not 6 million. This is 500 children there's some paperwork about them. There's something known about their families. And we certainly know from the news stories, some percentage of their parents are trying to get them back. It's just, you know, as I often say, what's the long-term strategy here? Because it's not deterrence. The numbers did not change in terms of immigration over the course of this horror that the Trump administration unleashed on children and their families. They did not serve as a deterrent. So what's your long-term strategy? 500 kids that are forced orphans? It's madness
by us. Talking
okay.
to Juliette Kayyem.
So Juliette Kayyem, yesterday we learned that the president ordered to declassify these documents and text messages having to do with the Russia investigation. He claimed he wants to do that for transparency, total transparency. This morning, CNN, where you appear, reported that the Department of Justice will redact a lot of the information from those documents. So what are we to make of this?
A line that Trump crossed. It sort of didn't get the play that it ought to have because of Stormy Daniels and Kavanaugh and all that stuff. But I mean, basically, the subject of the investigation is demanding that the evidence potentially against him be declassified. That's not acceptable from the Department of Justice's viewpoint. Instead of resigning, as you know, the attorney general and the deputy attorney general might otherwise do, I think they know that that their presence at the Department of Justice, absent Trump firing them, which he still is not willing to do, means that they should play games with the classification system. So what they're going to do is they're going to release these text messages at the demand of the president. Once again, the subject of this investigation, and it will have nothing, right? Because they're going to redact almost anything that would be of relevance. This process, you know, it's just that maybe this is the fourth or fifth time with the help of Devin Nunes, a House Republican, and others, that the White House has sort of demanded the release of something which sort of gets thrown back in their face. Every single time this happens, the evidence actually suggests that the investigation is solid and that the evidence against the White House and others is pretty strong. So, but the president doesn't care anymore. I mean, the president will at this stage, as I've been saying, I mean, he has no other hands to play but to mess up the investigation, because the way the investigation is going with Manafort's plea and then, of course, now, you know, with Michael Flynn's sentencing schedule.
Yeah.
What does that tell
you?
What
does it tell us? That essentially they've gotten everything out of him that they want to get?
And then, I don't think it's a coincidence that Manafort's testimony is corroborating, and therefore they're not thinking that Mike Flynn is hiding anything. So why would you now want to sentence this guy? You know, why not keep him unsentenced so that he's yours? It's because there's sufficient corroborating evidence to get rid of Mike Flynn and make him pay the time that he is going to pay. And I don't know what that number is going to be, 6 months, a year, 2 years.
Can I just give the background so people understand the significance of this? He was pled 10 months ago.
Right.
There have been four delays in sentencing requested by the special counsel. So this is not like a normal course of events. The fact that Mueller is now asking for a sentencing date, I agree with you, speaks to your conclusion. So
that he alone is not necessary. There's sufficient corroborating evidence. But, you know, this is, you know, it's in the background right now, just given everything else going on in the news. But, you know, to head down Bob Mueller and his team, and if you just read the tea leaves, they are continuing pressing forward.
You guys are both lawyers. I'm not, but
barely.
We're both lawyers.
Yeah, do not hire us.
Well, to impede in an investigation that's still ongoing, as the president is asked to do by declassifying these documents. Isn't there some obstruction of justice?
Well, that presumably is what Mueller adds to the evidence. But
he has the power to declassify anything he wants, by the way, even if it's over. But it doesn't mean that it's not exactly.
Right.
He has the authority
to fire Comey. But if the motive is an obstruction of justice charge, I have long believed, and I could be proved wrong, but, you know, the idea that all that Mueller has is obstruction of justice, I think, is wishful thinking on Republicans' part. Because you see, what they're trying to say is the only thing that you know, they have, you know, Trump on is potential obstruction of justice. And that's just because they've been after him since day one. This case is much bigger than an obstruction of justice charge. I mean, it helps to have one, but there's no way you look at the evidence that's being disclosed in the Manafort case, the Flynn case, and then any of these public documents,
Cohen,
that the idea that this is just about obstruction of justice is ridiculous.
Well, you've always thought it was about money.
It's always about money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's your theory?
The president is so compromised by what the Russians have done to prop up his finances, including the potential that includes, you know, pictures or sexual misconduct or whatever. But I, you know, overall, the evidence, public evidence shows, right? We'd forget the collusion part, that we had a president who's compromised by a foreign enemy. And we can take, if that's not grounds for impeachment, I don't know what is. I think that's what Mueller is going to do. And I just want to remind everyone, the only reason why you think, right, the public thinks Mueller is going to come out with a report or whatever is because the Republicans and Trump are telling you that. We have no idea what is next for the Mueller team. It might be more indictments. It might be closing down, whatever. But the idea that, oh, it's just going to be some report is, we don't know that. I mean, there could be 8 more potential indictments, you know, down the lane. So I just, you know, everything that is being narrated by the White House about Mueller's limitations is just false, because it only is coming from them.
Speaking of White House, this, the president is doing an interview with Hill TV.
Oh, my God.
And he, I don't know if it's the most vicious attack on his attorney general yet, but it's a strong one. I don't have an attorney general. It's very sad, Trump told Hill TV. Can I ask the same thing that I feel so childish even asking this question. Is this one of these things where now we celebrate Jeff Sessions?
It's so weird.
Because thank goodness he has the courage, despite being humiliated, despite his past that is this sketchy at best. Thank God Jeff Sessions has the courage to stay there and to be part of the resistance to Donald Trump.
Isn't that the weirdest thing?
Is that where
we are? Meanwhile, he'll, you know, walk, you know, 3 decades backwards on civil rights and criminal justice reform,
exactly.
Whatever else. So first of all, Trump may not have an attorney general, but the United States does. And this is just his language
point.
Is so so Trump, right?
I don't have an attorney general.
It's my FBI. Remember, he says my CIA. It's this idea that this apparatus works only for his pleasure, so to speak, is just something that I think we've never encountered, not even with Nixon, with any president, and his inability to be able to separate his own desires from a common or a national interest is just still shocking, and I will continue to be shocked about it. So I think, you know, why Trump, you know, tends not to fire people. He tends to have other people fire them, but we'll see what Sessions does. I think it's just to my point about Trump views everything through the prism of Trump. You know, he's visiting Florence right now.
And
I don't know if people heard in the briefing about what was the damage. The one question he asked, how's my golf course?
Oh, I didn't. Is that really true?
Yeah, he asked about the area around his golf course. This lake, I don't know the name of it. I mean, so this, the separation of me
Maybe
and the United States
Maybe it was with a smile
interest.
On his face, but of course,
Who
people
knows?
Have died, so it's
and
not
also,
much of
yeah, I mean, the guy doesn't, know, he doesn't, the, Trump has no sense of humor. I mean,
but
there's
there is
no
a, there is a plot. I hate to always look for a silver lining, but that's the kind of person I am. It appears it's going to be just weeks until I can get personal texts from Donald Trump on my cell phone.
Oh,
is that
I know.
What is? I never even heard of this presidential alert system.
I am, yes.
Signed by Barack Obama.
Yeah,
yes.
Come on.
What is
yeah,
it?
So basically, those of us who are old enough, you know, when you only had 3 TV stations, they would come on and do the emergency alert system and a test. It's a way to be able to communicate with the American public. Time moves. Technology changes. No one has no one under the age of 20 has TVs anymore or watches on TVs anymore. And no one has landlines anymore. So they had to upgrade the means of communication, not the content, the means. How do you actually get an emergency alert system out? And so by law, they were testing the carriers, so AT&T, Sprint, all the different carriers. I think there's up to 36, right? So
and you can't opt out.
And it's basically as a condition of having a contract with that carrier, you're going to get an alert that simply says, you know, an emergency alert, and it's testing it. And the whole point of testing it is then you could see, are all carriers equally able to get to their customers with an alert. So so that's totally normal. So you're upgrading the means of communication to the American public, forget the content, fine. The problem with it is twofold. One, of course, is, you know, the president has no credibility in terms of does he lie or not lie. Then, you know, there's people who are just like, I can't believe I have to get a text from him. But I think that gets to the second point. This is now not by statute being called the presidential alert system. You know, that was a decision to call it that. And given this president and truth, you would think that a system that wants to test veracity and test capability would just have called it what it should have been called, which is a national alert system through, you know, through the, you know, through the cell carriers. So I think people were sort of getting a little bit worked up, maybe rightfully so, that it was called the presidential alert system. The statute, not that this administration always follows statutes, the statute prohibits the use of the national alert system for anything except terrorism, natural disaster.
So we can't delegate it to like Sean Hannity and say, Sean, tonight you can tweet.
Watch
Judge Judy. By the way,
in
light of Juliet's response, Judge
Jeanine,
in light of Marjorie's response, Juliet's response to what Marjorie said, you're both lawyers. Rob just tweeted, whoever Rob is, law offices of Browdy and Kayyem, we're lawyers, don't hire us.
Don't hire us.
That's our motto.
Right. You know, Juliet Kayyem, you are our national security advisor, but you're also a security mom. That's the title of your terrific book about being a security mom.
Oh, you're going to bring up sharks, I hope?
I am going to bring up sharks because we have this young man, Arthur Medici, 26, from Revere. He's about to get married, looked like a terrific kid who loved to boogie board as thousands and thousands of young people do, killed in Wellfleet last Saturday. There was a story in the paper today about improving cell phone service down there, which I guess is terrible.
Yeah.
And people were
on
cutting
the beaches,
out.
Is
on the
that
beach.
What it says? Because it is hot.
Cell phone systems, the
Yeah, that
systems.
People were calling 911 dispatch, couldn't hear them. But, I mean, what security mom, what's your security advice for Cape Codders?
Stay out of the water.
The oceans belong to the sharks and the seals. There's not much you can do. I mean, you can have transparency, and they do this on the Cape. You can, tag sharks. You can have flyovers to alert if a shark is seen and to alert beachgoers. But it's their home, not ours. And the Cape will start to get a reputation, if it hasn't already, that it's a, that there is a risk of going to the water. Now, once again, millions of people have went to the Cape this summer.
Right.
We have one attack post-summer. We don't know the circumstances. I mean, we're not blaming the victim, but just in other words, were these unique circumstances that could justify what was going on, or explain what was going on. But there's actually, there's not much you can do. You're basically saying, how do you rid the waters of sharks?
Well,
you
John
either kill
Dowd.
The,
well,
you
that's
kill
what
the,
John Dowd, yeah.
the
attorney,
lawyer,
wants to kill the seals.
Yeah. Where do you write? The Cape Cod Times? Is
I
that
think
what
so.
You, yeah.
Yeah, kill the seals. That's not.
Can I say something?
That's not a long-term solution. Because if the sharks do not have seals to eat, I mean, I don't even understand this. Like, so what? So they're. I don't even get this. Like, okay. So now, what's their prey? If you take away their prey, they may go somewhere else. That place will have people, right? So they're okay, but they're not our people, I guess, is the argument. Or they will look for other prey. Right. So, I mean, it is, so part of this is the law. There's not a lot of good long-term solutions except for transparency, communication, alert systems. There's an app that exists. I forget the name of it. When I rented the house this summer,
they
said
shark
app.
But, don't you start your book with a 9/11 thing and what you're going to do with your kids and that sort of thing? So I love the Cape. And actually, I was there in the middle of all this at the end of August. Not the death recently, but the guy from New York
who
was bitten, the 61-year-old guy was bitten. What do you do with kids? I mean, I don't want to hurt their business. I don't think you have, at least now, have kids go in the water.
Really?
Go out a little ways.
Well, except one of the sharks, if you read the stories, was sighted very, very, very close. Not one of the attacking sharks.
Yeah,
sighted very close to shore.
A great white shark can't.
You'd
come
have
in
young
kids.
You'd
of
have
water.
Young. You'd have young kids going
well,
to ocean water.
A little ways. I mean, they're too big to come into 2 feet of water. They can be the man from the older man was 8 to 10 feet of water, and this Arthur Medici was boogie boarding. He was like surfing.
Yeah.
So he was pretty far out, but. I wouldn't. Yeah, I could go in a little ways.
I think they're going to have a real. And I, listen. I love the Cape. I don't hurt anybody's business. There were signs on every beach.
Yeah,
and
I thought that we were
tons
on beach
of
too,
signage
yeah.
absolutely everywhere. But I mean, that guy, the harbor master, who a month or so ago,
well, you'll have to be different.
Who said this is a new world. I mean, it was almost like Jaws. The guy in
well, yeah, that's I think that means you're not going to be. You shouldn't be swimming 20 feet, 30 feet, 40 feet off from the shore. And maybe you should get the Shark app. Which is, what is the Shark app?
It's just a notification. Look, the, look.
It's imperfect, by the way. We used it when we were there.
Sharks live in the water, so there is a risk. I would still go to the Cape. I would still have my kids to, you know, be in the ocean, but we have a new threat. It's not a huge threat, and you have to figure out ways in which the public is made aware and ways in which you can try to, you know, not have sharks on shore. But there's no perfect solution to this. It's their home.
Yeah.
And it is rare for them to attack a human being. But killing the seals.
You're hearing more and more of that now. We got to start killing the seals.
Yeah.
Okay, Juliet, good to see you.
Okay, bye. Happy Yom Kippur to my family.
Happy
Yom Kippur. What is it? What is it?
The Day of Atonement?
Okay, Yom Kippur.
Oh, my God.
You know, my kids and husband are Jewish.
I know they
are. I have to do this right.
Yeah.
Well, you didn't.
Okay.
I think they're supposed to be atoning today. Okay,
by the way,
she made kugel in her defense because that's what you're breaking the fast.
Tonight, okay, bagels. Fine. It's literally, oh, do you want to know what kugel is? It's literally
exactly what
pasta, butter, sugar.
No, delicious.
Butter, more sugar.
And potatoes. Do you put potato in it?
Or no, raisins.
Oh, raisins. Okay, fine.
I think it's delicious.
Bye.
It's like candy.
That's it. Right.
Okay, bye.
See you, bye.
Juliet Kahn, thank you very much. Juliet Kahn is our national security expert. She joins us every week. She's on the faculty of Harvard's Kennedy School and analyst for CNN and CEO of Zemcar. Up next, after surviving a hurricane, people trapped in flooded areas face other life-threatening risks like snakes and infections and even diseases that can lead to death. We're also going to talk about how much you can drink. Medical ethicist Art Kaplan joins us for that and more next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. At a critical time for Planned Parenthood, with the GOP's constant attempts to strip funding and a Supreme Court that could weaken or even overturn Roe v. Wade, the organization has hired a new president. She's an immigrant, a doctor, a critic of Trump's cuts to public health programs. With a physician now in charge, could Planned Parenthood protect itself by repositioning it as more of a health care provider and not, as pro-lifers like to characterize it, an abortion clinic? Joining us online for his take on this and other medical ethical headlines is Art Kaplan. Art's at Drs. William F. and Virginia Connolly Minichair and Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. Hey there, Art Kaplan.
Hey, how are you?
Hello, Art Kaplan.
Excellent.
Well, before we ask you about this new head of Planned Parenthood, I just want to take a little bit from Kate Czernicke's story in the New York Times about her, that she and her family came here from China with $40 in their name. It was after the Tiananmen Square tragedy. And Dr. Wen, what's her first name?
Oh, Dr. Nguyen.
I'll find it in a second. Excuse me. Told the committee when she was chosen that she and her mother and sister relied on Planned Parenthood for health care. And she graduated from college at 18, became a Rhodes Scholar, then went back and volunteered at Planned Parenthood. And her emphasis at Planned Parenthood is all about women's health care, cancer screenings and contraception. I'm hoping this could be a new day for Planned Parenthood, but maybe I'm being too optimistic.
Not a chance.
I'm with you, Art.
Okay.
Planned Parenthood is tied in the minds of pro-lifers to abortion. It is, it sees abortion as one of the health services among many, many, many things that it does. It has refused to yield back off on that service. And no, I don't think it matters. It's nice to have this physician. Looks very qualified and will be a good spokesperson for the many things, as you note, Marjorie, that Planned Parenthood does. Certainly abortion services are not the major thing that they do, but there is not a chance. What is it, 25 years of war to defund Planned Parenthood in Congress? No, I don't see it. I think we're dug in. I don't think minds are going to be changed. I think it's going to be you know, it's the driving issue on this Supreme Court Kavanaugh confirmation. You know, that's it. I mean, basically Trump has said to pro-lifers, I'm going to get you a court that doesn't like Roe versus Wade. I'm going to get you a conservative social court. I'm going to get you somebody who doesn't like Planned Parenthood. And I think that's where we are.
But so you want to rephrase your question, Marjorie? Well, by the way, her first name is Leanna.
Leanna, I apologize. That was terrible of me not to have that right in front of me. But the thing is, I just can't resist pointing out that the reason the abortion rate has declined and declined and declined in the United States is because of Planned Parenthood, because the availability of cheap, inexpensive birth control, because the availability of teenage girls to go down to Planned Parenthood and get birth control that they might not otherwise get. So it's hypocritical stance on their part.
I think Arch's point is, what do the facts have to do with it?
Well, I just think it's important to have the facts on the table.
Look, some of the pro-lifers are also opposed to that liberal contraception policy, so they don't like it. They want abstinence. They don't want anything that looks like it might be compatible with having sex before marriage, so that's trouble. But in general, despite all the good, the HPV screenings, you know, cervical cancer screenings, the well prenatal visits, the whole kit and caboodle, boy, I have to say this is trench warfare. Everybody's dug in. I don't think it's going to change any minds on the pro-life side about the evil that they see Planned Parenthood to be.
By the way, one last, since Marjorie said it's important to get the facts out, regardless of what the political outcome is, the conventional wisdom is that abortions comprise somewhere in the single digits as a percentage of the services.
3%.
Well, that's according to Planned Parenthood, but even critics that don't acknowledge that it's much more than 10. So it's a very small percentage of what they do. We're talking to Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist.
So, and you know, I should jump in and say, I would not change policy if I were Planned Parenthood either. It's a legitimate legal service. It's something that is part of women's health. If you want to argue about whether or not it's right to get an abortion, I still believe it's a moral argument, and you try to take that up with women when they're not entering a clinic. You know, you do it in church, you do it in school, you do it at the dinner table, you do it at the water cooler. It's not like you can't have a discussion, but I would still keep the service available.
Okay, Art Kaplan, let's move on to what may be happening right now in the Carolinas. This very upsetting story from the Washington Post about all the sharp objects, the snakes, the bacterial infections, the terrible disease-carrying mosquitoes, the dangers that could be facing people in these floodwaters. What's the deal?
You know, I think what happens is we hear about floods and we think, oh, the pure rains fall from the sky and the level is high, but, you know, the water's pretty clean. It's all just poured out of the heavens. Look, if there's flooding, and we saw this all the way back to Katrina, all kinds of toxic sludge and waste gets into that water. So in addition to critters, the snakes and the things that might bite you, there are, I hate to do this for the listeners, but North Carolina is home to some of the largest ponds full of pig feces on the planet Earth.
Manure lagoons, we talked about.
Manure lagoons.
Yeah.
And if they flood, they're like the worst disease threats all over the place. There's also, let's say, I think I read that they had to kill just in Fayetteville or somewhere 3 million chickens. Well, where do you think their bodies are? They're not having a ceremony with a funeral and Jim offering some kind of eulogy to the, you know, life of the chickens. They're floating around in all this goop. So, and then add in toxic waste from the homes that are flooded, you know, minerals and batteries and boat fuel and so on and so on. It's really a public health menace. So the reason to fear hurricanes isn't just because of the wind, as we're seeing. It's because of the floods, and then it's because of the pollution. And one last thing, the North Carolina officials have never done anything about these pig latrines that they've allowed to exist, and people have warned them about them for a long time, and they just ignored those warnings.
I'll tell you, manure lagoons, just the whole terminology.
Well, also, you know, the story talks about the fact that you can get really sick. It's not just maybe skin rashes, which are bad enough, or some poor guy had these painful sores, but you can develop kidney and liver failure and even die.
Sure. All these pollutants get in you and your kidneys can't handle them, or you pick up terrible bacteria, and you get what's called sepsis, infections of the bloodstream that we don't have necessarily the drugs that we can counter. And if you get sick and you're in a flooded house, you're still not near a hospital. It's not like we're going to be able to go grab you and, you know, rush you in because it's hard to get you. You may be cut off or isolated, or maybe we don't even know you're there. So flooding is a public health disaster. I, you know, when Trump says we're doing a great job and officials say, you know, we're ready for the waters to rise, what they're talking about is, you know, getting out boats and moving people around. But if you leave a legacy of toxic waste, I don't think you're doing a great job.
We're talking to Art Kaplan. Art, I need your advice on something. You know, Marjorie and I are always meeting with our producers trying to figure out, you know, how to make the show even more appealing. And we occasionally
try. Well, the pig latrines are pretty good. Yeah.
Well, that's why we had that set. But the other thing we're contemplating is I was thinking of taking brain armor, then banging my head against the wall on the air to see if any damage was done. Mm-hmm. Is that something mm-hmm. you'd advise or no?
Well, probably not. Okay. So this is a thing you can look on the internet, and there's a lot of other stuff like we have. By the way, we're talking about football here. So you're a worried parent or a player, and you think I'd like to do something about concussions or either fix them if I get one. So there's companies out there selling this stuff called Brain Armor, which is omega-3 oils. And they're saying, you know, there's a study that was once done on a mouse. I don't know if the mouse played football, but whatever, that they seem to have some recovery if they took this stuff. There's no human studies. The whole thing is bunk. It's part of the general internet, you know, if you breathe fresh air, stand on your head, and chant three times in the direction of Dr. Oz, you can prevent something or other. No, it won't help you. We don't know what to do about concussion. And by the way, the same ads often say things like, you can buy a super padded helmet. Well, the problem with concussion is it's your brain banging on your helmet, meaning your skull inside your head. So padding up the outside of your head doesn't do anything to prevent concussion. We still don't know how to manage that problem, and we certainly don't have consensus about how to treat it, and we certainly don't have any view that vitamins or whatever they call it, brain armor, is going to help you.
It says brain armor for strong brains. You know, and the story we're reading makes the point that, well, it never says it's going to protect you from concussions. It clearly says it without saying it. And, you know, what I'm amazed by, and we've had these kinds of discussions with you in the past about other contexts, is there no regulation of these at all? I mean,
Well, you know, these are sold as vitamins or foods, and they're much less regulated than, say, a drug making a claim. So that's how you get away with it. I could sort of say blueberries, they're great for you. They have all kinds of antioxidant properties. People who take them live a long time. I don't want to bring back our favorite subject, the actress with her egg, but
even
if Gwyneth,
I had her brother-in-law on my show last night. Actually, Evan Falchuk was on with me. Her brother-in-law.
No
last
way.
Night. No. Her husband. Her husband's brother.
Yeah, he ran for governor.
Yeah, he did. Okay, yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. Not the Falchuk that has the egg inserted.
But in any event, you know, foods and sort of quote unquote natural things get away easy on the regulatory side.
You know, I was going to ask you about just omega-3s in general. Isn't the jury out on whether, aren't they supposedly, there's some question about whether they can, do these supplements help heart disease or don't help heart disease?
That's right.
Or,
and I think I saw this. Listeners will email me and fix this. But I'm pretty sure there was just a study out that said, no, they don't. That I know there was a vitamin D study that popped up and said, doesn't seem to do anything preventative. I know there was an aspirin study that just popped up for older people who were healthy that said, no, don't seem to see benefit to them. And I'm pretty sure I saw one on these omega fatty acid things that said, no, not seeing anything there. So I'm not against it. I wish they helped, you know, it would be nice. But data isn't backing it up so far.
So when you read all these studies and you're so
confused. Oh, and fish oil too.
I used to take that too.
Is that not worth it either?
No, it doesn't seem to show any preventive effect either.
No, but it's good for the fish. So there's
good for the fish.
The debate is raging about how much, if any, alcohol is good for you. I think we discussed with you a couple of months ago this whole notion that moderation is not acceptable. Well, the latest flare-up actually is a local one. It was reported by Stat, the great adjunct of the Boston Globe that deals with technology, health, etc. Dr. Michael Siegel from BU School of Public Health is upset with the National Institutes of Health for putting out one arm of theirs, National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, saying drinking too much alcohol can increase your risk of developing certain cancers, especially as it regards breast cancer. And then this Dr. Siegel responds by saying this is in direct contradiction with the scientific evidence, which shows that even light to moderate drinking increases risks of breast cancer, meaning too much implies that if you really slosh yourself, it's going to be a problem. But any level is a problem. One, he's right, I think, is he not? And two, isn't this the same arm of the NIH that was taking tens of millions of dollars from the alcohol industry to begin with and was so discredited?
Right, they were trying to launch up a study in cahoots with the alcohol industry to assess the impact or health benefit, actually, of moderate drinking. I forget how they defined it, but it was pretty moderate. But I'm going to say this. We're not sure what to make of coffee, and we're not really sure what to make of alcoholic beverages. But what I do know is if you have a beer gut, that's bad for you. So what I'm going to get back to is my old hobby horse, better to go after the risks we know than argue about the, I wonder if a glass of wine is going to increase my cancer risk of breast cancer 0.01%. Maybe it will. But if you weigh 270 pounds, let's pay attention to that. You know, I was telling somebody the other day who was going on and on about the importance of getting genetic testing. Look, here's a test. Buy yourself a bathroom scale and go stand on it every day. For a third of Americans who are obese, that's telling them about a real risk factor. So it's fun to get on the margins of all this, but
We're talking to Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist. You know, one of the things we talk to you a lot about, Art, in the years that we've known you are organ donations, transplants, that sort of thing. And now there's a debate, even though it doesn't seem that one side has much going for it, about the advisability of taking an organ from someone who's died from an overdose. What's the controversy and what should the bottom line be?
Yeah. Well, sadly, this opioid epidemic is causing many young people to overdose and die. Turns out many of their organs are still salvageable, but people worry if it came from a drug addict, does that mean there's a higher risk of disease, hepatitis, HIV, something I could catch from this donor? And I'm going to say there is a slightly higher risk. People who, you know, exchange dirty needles, for example, on the heroin side, they could pose risk as a donor. But when I talk to people who are waiting for a kidney, waiting for a heart, if I said, hey, I've got an organ donor, the person died of an overdose, was found in a heroin gallery or something, they'd ask a question like, do you think there's more risk? But they're not going to turn that organ down. They're so difficult to get, it's almost silly to argue about the idea that you're going to say, no, I'll pass. I'll wait for the pure and wholesome death of Art Kaplan. And then, you know, give me his parts. People are so backed up on the waiting list that even though there are some increased risks, it's almost silly to talk about whether or not we're going to use them. Of course we're going to use them.
But what I don't quite understand from this story is when I assume you're surrounded by a phalanx of doctors and others when you're contemplating doing this, and I assume the doctors are telling the person who needs the transplanted organ, your odds of getting an organ if you reject this one from the person who young person who died from an overdose is X, which is small.
Tiny.
So how I don't understand if doctors are doing their jobs, why the refusal rate on the part of those who need a transplant is as absurdly high as it is.
Well, I'm not sure it's high. It's some people do refuse because they're afraid, they're scared, they don't understand.
Let me read you this one line from this piece in Stat. Consider a recent analysis that examined more than 100,000 instances of kidney transplant candidates declining increased risk donor kidneys. 5 years later, go ahead.
Yeah, that may happen because kidneys have that backup of dialysis. So you're not going to drop dead necessarily in the next year. If you pass on an organ, you might not like dialysis, but maybe you can hang in there longer. You wouldn't see that in hearts or livers or other organs.
Okay.
You know, you're going to die right away. But okay, fair enough. Still, doctors should be doing their job. They should understand that the risks, even of things like hepatitis, you know, we have some pretty good medicines now, and they seem to work. They're not cheap, but they seem to work, and you can take those if you did get an infection. That discussion should take place when you're signing up to be on the wait list, not the day the organ comes available.
Makes total sense.
You know, next week we should talk about all these ads I'm seeing about livers, which you just mentioned, of the possibility of people getting out of the line, as the ad says, for the long wait for livers and getting a live liver donation, which I didn't
think.
I don't know if those are legit ads or what, but they're certainly all over the place all of a sudden.
They're all over the place, and people have been traveling off to places like China. Mm-hmm. And saying, I'm going to hurry up and get, you know, a liver there, which is what it means, and we can talk about it next week, is you're probably getting one from an executed prisoner. If they're going to be able to supply you with a liver within 2 or 3 weeks of your getting there, how would they do it except they had to kill somebody with your blood type?
On that note, so Art, before...
and folks, remember, heavy drinking during this show is encouraged. We know we're upbeat as can be here,
Before you tell us what's on this week's Everyday Ethics podcast, Marjorie and I listened to last week's. One, I think because you told us to. And two, because we became sleep-obsessed when I think we told you we had the morning show on our old radio station for a couple of years, and we had to get up at 3 o'clock to do it, etc. In this podcast of yours on sleep, you talk about the war on sleep. Tell people what you're talking about.
Well, you know, you could think of it as sleep shaming. It's sort of like if I show up at the office and somebody comes up to me and says, you know, I slept 9 hours last night and I need 9 hours every night, I may say to them, hey, you know, that's not productive. Why don't you cut that back to 5 hours a night? And write some more articles and prepare some more lectures and do some more stuff. Nobody needs 9 hours a night. What are you, like a slacker? Now, of course, different people need different amounts of sleep. There's nothing wrong with getting adequate rest, and it's good for your health. And in the long run, I'm pretty sure you'll be more productive. But we have this culture that basically people run around and say, you know, I haven't slept for 96 hours. We also know that if you're doing things like driving a bus or operating heavy equipment, or trying to be a computer programmer, that's not a good idea because you're going to make errors.
You know, I'm sorry, Marjorie.
You argued that there's some ageist stuff going on, too, that, you know, 22.
There is.
Yeah. What did you mean by that?
You know, the 22-year-old who's more vigorous may not need as much sleep as an older person, although I have to say as I continually creak along in age, my sleep gets rougher. That is, I wake up more in the middle of the night. But generally speaking, you know, the sleep habits of your 22-year-old graduate student are not necessarily those that ought to be extended to every human. That doesn't make any sense.
You know,
so the culture, you know, it's got this attitude that sleep is bad because you're not doing anything. It sounds like Henry Ford, you know, on methamphetamines or something.
You know, I anecdotally agree, and I observe the same thing about the sleep shaming that you're talking about. But also anecdotally, my sense is the medical profession, the healthcare world, has spent much more energy in the last 15 or 20 years focusing on how important sleep is as part of your health regimen. Am I imagining that, or is that actually a development?
More lately, sleep is finally started to pop up as an area of real study to try and understand both circadian rhythms, what happens when you get off, you know, when you travel, for example. That's an area that people have started to look at when you're crossing time zones. But for a long time, medicine didn't pay much attention to sleep. It just took it for granted. And then when you started to have sleep disorders, sleeping pills, those were used without very much knowledge. So it's better. It's getting better.
You know, I just realized, you know, who is probably the queen of sleep shaming? Marjorie.
Me?
When we took over the morning show at the old place, I went to a bunch of sleep doctors. Every morning I'd come in the next day and tell you that I went to a sleep doctor. What would you say to me? You did not.
Well, because...
You did not.
All right, this is because he has had more MRIs than anybody else in Massachusetts.
What's it got to do with sleep doctors?
Jim Crowder is a total hypochondriac. You know, I mean, right. I think basically you know that if you get up at 3 o'clock in the morning every day, it's a problem because that's not natural.
Exactly.
It screws up your circadian rhythms.
I'm with Marjorie. She's basically condemning you for your insistent pursuit of witch doctors.
Exactly.
It's a witch hunt. So what is this week's podcast that you're going to tell us
we
have to listen to?
We were going to go in a different direction. We actually haven't taped this one yet, but all of a sudden it becomes interesting to ask a fundamental ethics question. How much should bad behavior when you're young determine your future as you're an adult? And so obviously we're thinking of the Kavanaugh accusation about bad behavior when he was a high school kid. You know, I do sit there and listen a little bit to those accusations and think, people are going to hold me accountable for high school? I mean, not for attacking people or mauling people, but just, you know, bad behavior.
Well, can I help you?
That's bad.
Can I help you here, since you haven't taped it yet? I had former federal judge Nancy Gertner on with me the other night, and I asked her that exact question. Even if he were to acknowledge this, Kavanaugh, should the sins of a 17-year-old be visited on a 53-year-old?
She had a great answer.
And her basic answer is, for most jobs, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're watching, Marjorie, the answer is no. For this job, which is a lifetime appointment,
which has huge power over the bodies of every woman in America.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a different ball of wax.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Just being an NYU professor, who cares what you did?
Exactly.
Art, it's great to talk to you. We'll talk to you next
Thank
week, and we'll
God
be listening.
That.
See you.
Bye now.
Bye.
Art Kaplan joins us every week. He's the doctor's William F. Virginia Comedy Mini Chair and Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center and the co-host of the Everyday Ethics Podcast, which we just talked about. Thank you again, Art. Coming up, it turns out you can have happiness two ways. Harvard Business School's Michael Norton is here to explain how that can happen. He is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brady and Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 is behavioral economist Michael Norton. He joins us every month to explain ourselves to ourselves. Now, I hope I get this right. Marjorie, help me with this. If happiness is a state of mind, the key to happiness could be a two states of mind solution. Norton's research, I think, finds that we experience happiness in the moment, enjoying what we're doing right now. We can also find it by way of remembered happiness by reflecting on, I don't know, a great trip, a wedding, or whatever. And how we like our happiness, if we prefer the sum of the parts to the whole, can help us figure out how we should be living our lives and prioritizing our time. Is that right, Marjorie?
I believe that's right, but we're going to ask Michael to double-check in just a second.
Michael Norton is the Harold M. Brearley Professor of Business Administration at Harvard Business School. His latest book is Happy Money, The Science of Happier Spending. Hello there, Michael Norton.
How are you?
Okay, we have
Was
to start...
Was that close, by the way?
To what?
To what you devoted considerable amounts of time studying.
That's Let's get what... really basic here, can
yeah,
we?
Yeah, okay. So before you tell us what you did, experience versus remembered happiness. Explain to me what that is.
Yeah, so you can think about things in life that in the moment either feel good or bad, and then later on you look back at them and they feel good or bad to remember. And a lot of the times they line up, but they don't always line up. So one classic case is if you eat chocolate cake, an entire chocolate cake right now, feels really good. An hour later looking back, you feel like a jerk that you ate an entire chocolate cake. So we know that we can have these experiences that, or you run a marathon, in the moment it's really hard and awful, but for the rest of your life you look back and you say, thank God I did that.
Yes.
So we know that there's these, they're not exactly mismatches, but it's just, they don't always line up where if it's positive now, it's positive later. If it's negative now, it's negative later. And the question we had was, how do people try to construct their life? Do they try to construct it where every minute they're doing something they like? Or do they try to, which would be, you know, let's eat cake all the time. Or do they try to construct it where they set themselves up so that later on they can look back and say, I had a good life, which might mean training for a marathon for a year and having pain every day so that in 40 years you can look back and say, I ran a marathon and I feel really good about that.
But when you said, Michael Norton, how do people plan their life? My sense from having read this extract or whatever, the, is that what they call these things you do? What is this thing?
It's sort of distilled wisdom of the ages is how I refer to my work.
Whatever it is. You say, how do you plan your life? My sense was that it wasn't a planning issue, or maybe it is. It's rather a reflective issue, reflection issue, meaning I step back and say to myself, well, with that marathon, for example, was the experience of the marathon, the experience, whatever it's called, the memory or what do you call it? Experience what? Experienced happiness. Mm-hmm. That was one thing, but the remembered happiness is another thing. Do people actually say to themselves, hey, I'm going to go run a marathon because even though the experienced happiness is going to be minimal because it's going to be torture, the remembered happiness, I know we don't use these terms, mm-hmm. The remembered happiness is going to be so great because as I've been saying, I've been bragging about the marathons I finished, which were torture in New York City to Marjorie for the 20 years I've known her. Do people actually do that planning or is it after the fact that you decide whether the moment versus the look back was the preferred route? You know what I mean?
I think both can happen. But I think some things for sure we are thinking now, I'm going to do this now in order to later look back and think it's great. So one
people
example,
do that?
Think about, I don't mean, you know, you have an Excel spreadsheet or something. Yeah. But for example, the decision to have a child. I have heard from various sources that it can be somewhat painful.
So, childbirth, you mean?
For example, yeah. So you wouldn't choose to go through that just for the heck of it. You choose to go through that because you want to have a child that enriches your life. So it's not that you're saying, I'm going to trade off the pain of the pregnancy in order to look back and have a life where I got to be a parent. But it's in our behavior, in a sense. We make these decisions that might otherwise seem... like, why would you ever do that to yourself when you could eat chocolate cake? Well, the reason you do it is because you're trying to set yourself up for that life that's different.
But I also thought, and maybe I was wrong, that in childbirth, for example, that while you're having the baby, especially at the end, it is a little painful or usually painful or the worst pain most of us ever have. Or, but when you look back, you know, 6 months later or 10 years later, it was the biggest miracle of your life.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly his point.
Yeah. So you weren't – or this vacation thing, which I thought was a great example in the New York Times where this woman writes about how they went on this stressful vacation because they were from Florida. And they went to Washington, D.C. in the wintertime with their 8-year-old kid and they were freezing to death and, you know, they one of those regimented vacations and it wasn't very much fun. But then they look back on it as a wonderful family bonding kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think they're more common than we think, actually, that the positive ones end up negative and the negative ones end up positive. And again, I don't think that we sit down and think, today, how many negative things should I do in order to feel positive about them later? But if you look at how we live our lives, we're often making these trade-offs kind of now versus later, and how will we look back?
Even if it's not conscious.
Exactly.
So you gave us a couple examples of something that would be negative in the moment, the experienced issue versus the remembered issue. Do the reverse. Give us an example of something that's positive in the moment.
These are really these are self-control problems often.
Oh, yeah.
Like what? Like
drinking too much?
So, like, if I'm training to run a marathon, that's the negative thing, and then later I feel good about it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the flip of that is I sit on my couch all day. And I feel terrific at every moment. But when I'm 80, I say, oh, my God, I sat on my couch all day. Right. So all of them, the reverse of it is, in a sense, the other mistake, again, is too strong a word, but the other pattern in human behavior.
Yeah.
So did you set out to find out which we prefer or what was the goal here?
So first we just – so I should have said, by the way, this is an idea of my co-author, Cassie McGillner, who's at UCLA. The original idea was sort of how do we allocate – between these two. So we could do, again, every minute of every day, we could do, I just want to feel good right
now.
In
the moment, right.
And we could do, all I want to do is set myself up for when I'm 100, that I'll look back and think I had a good life. Now, obviously, nobody, well, maybe some people, but most people don't do the extremes. But what is it? Is it 50-50? Is it 60-40? You know, we really didn't know. So that was the initial question, was just how do people think about structuring their days and weeks and months?
And which do we prefer, experience or remembered happiness?
This is the hardest part, is that what we find is that if you ask people for today or this week, people tend to prefer doing things that will later make them think they had a good life.
I'm stunned by that.
So today I will say, I want to go for a run. Like, I really want to go for a run because later I'll be in good shape and blah, blah. But if you ask people over the course of a year, they say, no, I want to live a good life. And if you ask them over their lifetime, they say, no, I want to live a happy life where I enjoy myself as I go. And that was actually opposite what we expected. We thought people would, in the moment, choose the
instant gratification.
Exactly. Thing. And I think the reason for it is this is why we have all these self-control conflicts all the time, because we're constantly thinking, geez, I'd really like to eat that entire cake. Wait a minute. How am I going to feel about it later? Right? And that's sometimes we err toward the feel about it later, even more than we want to, because we also want to be able to look back and say, I had a great time and went to a lot of great restaurants in my life.
Yeah, this makes a lot of sense to me because
Why?
You think – because, well, for example
– why are you surprised?
it has to do, I think, with discipline and delayed gratification. And like, you know, I've been a newspaper reporter, columnist for most of my life. I really find writing to be very difficult and painful, and I really dread it, having to concentrate as much as I do. But if I've written something great or – I never really written anything
yes,
great,
have,
but pretty
actually,
good.
Marjorie, a lot
the
of great
pleasure
things.
I get out of it mm-hmm. is enormous. So I will really work hard and really struggle to get and then so I can say that was good.
Yeah.
So would you say in the case of Marjorie Egan, just so I understand this, that she is maybe subconsciously deciding that when it comes to her great skill of writing, that the remembered she has made a decision, again, even if it's not conscious, that the remembered happiness outweighs the experienced lack of happiness. Is that a fair description of what she decided?
Absolutely, or you would quit. As soon as it got hard to write after the first two words, you'd quit. Because who cares? I can
exactly.
just go and watch TV that's funny, right? And we make that decision a lot, too. I'm not saying we don't. But you're thinking, no, I want to finish this so that later on I'll have this.
Or I won't be humiliated and
but
embarrassed
see, I fired.
By making a fool of myself.
I think I'm
exactly.
the reverse on this. So we're going to take your calls in a minute at 877-301-8970 and have you assess, even if you haven't thought about it before, how you've lived your life. Is it living in the moment with this experienced happiness, or have you made a calculation like Marjorie may have, again, consciously or otherwise about her writing, about remembered happiness? You know, Marjorie knows, you may not. I've had weight issues my whole life. I don't have a big weight issue at the moment, but I've always had weight issues because I think I'm much more into the experienced happiness of
mm-hmm.
eating.
Mm-hmm.
I don't say to myself when I'm stuffing myself, which I find to provide great joy, oh, my God, I'm going to gain 10 pounds this month, and it's going to be torture. I say, God, this is like the best sauce, and it's the best whatever. I would think that I am the more typical, the less disciplined person than Marjorie. But am I?
You're not currently struggling, so you changed something.
Well, no, I guess the answer to that is true. That actually is right, by the way. I guess I have. You're right. You're absolutely right.
At some point, you said,
at this phase, I decide the remembered part of it is more important than the experience
part.
And
that is the struggle, I think. And by the way, there are people vary on this for sure. So I'm acting as though everybody chooses one or the other. Absolutely, some people are more on your end and some people are more on another end.
We're talking to Michael Norton from Harvard Business School. We're going to take a break and then we're going to get your calls and see which camp you were in. And I had never thought about this before, but now that I've read what Michael has written with his colleague and he's described it to us, I know most of the time which camp I'm in, and Marjorie described it too. We want you to describe how you've lived your life and which camp you're in.
Just one quick thing. Remember you used to have that poem on your desk or somewhere about work?
To Be of Use by Marge Piercy.
Yes. It's a great poem about how the satisfaction you get out of working hard and trying your best.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I don't know, maybe that's not part of this, but...
Did you give up on that? That's why you got rid of the poem?
No, I think I dropped some chocolate cake on it one day when I was eating a whole Sara Lee cake.
Yeah,
and it did get smudged and I had to throw it out. So why'd you bring that up? What was your point?
Because I just thought about that. I mean, I think I think maybe this is from going to Catholic.
What do you mean? It sort of fits your description of your writing?
If you don't try your best, you're always going to be disappointed.
Meaning even if it causes you some pain in the short term, is that what you're saying?
Yes, there's some obligation on you to try your best, or even to like to put together the best vacation for your kids so you can make that memory for them. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
I always feel like
I really fall short in the vacations because I don't do enough research and I kind of screw it up and we wind up in the wrong hotel and we're lost. But the last time I didn't do that, basically because I had my children organize the vacation, and I felt so much better about it.
It might end up being less memorable. So when things go well, often they just blur away, whereas the disasters sometimes, oddly, we remember them better later as a bonding experience. So again, there's a strange what feels good and bad now is not always later on how we look back and evaluate the experience. It's really interesting to me how we have these different modes that we think about our lives.
So I will feel better about the vacation that I was so disorganized. You went to some hotel and we were all in the pool and the ceiling fell down into the pool because it was a condemned hotel.
And they still make fun of you probably for it. And
it's also
like a
not
memory.
Just vacation. You vote on the wrong day. You go to the wrong dentist on the wrong day. We got to take a break and then we're going to come back and take your calls. Talking to Michael Norton, behavioral economist, about having happiness. Two ways. Coming up, we'll open the lines asking you how you like it in the here and now. Or, I guess, as a recollection, the number is 877-301-8970. Okay, you're listening to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And if you're just tuning in, we're talking to Harvard Business School's Michael Norton. He's with us. And we're going over his research, which finds that when it comes to happiness, now correct me if I get this wrong, Michael, there are two ways to experience it. In the moment, enjoying what you're doing right now, or by reminiscing back on, if that's not redundant, on a happy time. We're opening up the lines asking, where are you on this? 877-301-8970. Are you even conscious about these different kinds of happiness? You're more of the sentimentalist, someone who likes going through old videos or photo albums. You prefer your happiness in real time, I guess present tense or past tense. Is that fair? That's fair, yeah.
That's right. And by the way, the other interesting thing is if your spouse or partner has a different view than you, it can cause a lot of conflict. Ooh. So if people have stories to share about
that's good.
Their...
You know, fabulous.
Jim.
Oh, what?
Robert just emailed. This is why I need the emails. And says, I'm trying to think of something Jim might have done in his life that he'd feel good about later. I'm totally stuck.
Fine. What's that guy's name?
Robert.
Block him. Now, Michael, I'm a great admirer of yours, as I think you know. But the research is not original, obviously. I mean, do you ever see Dead Poets Society?
Never seen it.
Okay. You haven't really?
No, I'm just kidding.
Okay. Well, here is a clip from Dead Poets Society.
Is that the one with Darth Vader?
Which I think captures your thing. This is the famous Carpe Diem scene where English teacher John Keating, played brilliantly, obviously, by Robin Williams, asks a student named Pitts to read a poem. Just listen up.
Now, Mr. Pitts. It's a rather unfortunate name. Mr. Pitts. Where are you? Pitts, will you open your hymnal, page 542? Read the first stanza of the poem you find there.
To the virgins to make much of time?
Yes, the one. Somewhat appropriate, isn't it?
Gather ye rosebuds while ye may. Old time is still a-flying. And this same flower that smiles today, tomorrow will be dying.
Thank you, Mr. Pitts. Gather ye rosebuds while ye may. The Latin term for that sentiment is carpe diem. Now, who knows what that means?
Carpe diem. That's seize the day.
Very good. Mr.
Meeks.
Meeks. Another unusual name. Seize the day. Gather ye rosebuds while ye may. Why does the writer use these lines?
Because he's in a hurry.
No. Ding! Thank you for playing anyway. Because we are food for worms, lads. Because believe it or not, each and every one of us in this room is one day going to stop breathing, turn cold, and die.
What a great scene. 877-301-8970. We're talking about what Michael Norton calls experienced happiness versus remembered happiness in the here and now, as opposed to looking back on things gone by. Jill in Providence, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Thank you so much for calling. Hi.
Hi. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. So I'm excited I got to hear your show today. It's pretty poignant in my life right now. So my husband and I are getting ready to make a fairly big financial sacrifice. And I think to the topic at hand, we've both kind of been opposite. I'm more of a realist than save now for the future. He's more of a live in the moment and experience things. So we are in our mid-30s and have rented apartments for a long time. I was in graduate school and just other financial things. So now we are looking to purchase a multifamily home, which we both don't want to do. We have no, like, real interest in being landlords or, you know, sharing space for another 5 or so years. But we're kind of have made the decision to make this big sacrifice now in order to maybe have a better, more secure financial future. So I just thought it was an interesting, you know, it's very poignant in our lives right now, and just kind of thought, wonder what you guys have to say about that and like the magnitude of the sacrifice now in order to possibly have a benefit in 20 years.
Chill, don't go away. This is right up Michael Norton's alley. So, Michael Norton?
I'm a real estate agent, so I think, you know, we just heard Robin Williams say carpe diem, and of course we can't just carpe diem because we have to do things like, you know, take care of our health and whatever else, but it does sound like a long commitment that would make you unhappy. I think my advice would be screen your tenants extremely carefully. Because it's a long road with tenants. And if you have tenants that you like, then it can enrich your life, actually. And if you have tenants that are terrible, it can't. So even within the decision you've made, try to think about ways to make it on a day-to-day basis experientially better. And I think that's hopefully more possible to do.
Jill, good luck with it. Let us know how it goes. We appreciate your call. Linda in Littleton, you're on Boston Public Radio with Michael Norton from Harvard Business School. Hi there, Linda.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi.
My own personal happiness has to do with really squeezing every drop from every day and enjoying everything good that comes my way and taking what's difficult and knowing that I can meet the challenge or I can pass it. And I think that's a function of getting older and being 68 that I've learned how to allow that life is highly imperfect and there's a lot of challenges and the absolute joy of being is what you come into as you age or should come into. And so that means that the love given and the love received is the joy of my life and also being with nature and enjoying every good thing.
Jesus.
Wow.
So,
Linda,
don't go away.
You are impressive.
You know, Linda, the first two callers make a point, I think, that is so painfully obvious. I can't believe I didn't ask it before they called. You have a 30-something calling saying, I'm willing to sacrifice happiness in the short term for what we hope is happiness in the long term. And you have Linda, who I think you're 68, Linda, is that what you said? Who Linda is in her 60s, who says, you know, I'm living every single, is it a generational, is there a divide? I assume there is. Yes, not just these two.
There is a bit, and it's absolutely the case that as you get older, you start prioritizing your day-to-day happiness more than the 30-year, 40-year time horizon, literally because, you know, if you're 88 years old,
right, 40 years.
But I think it does explain, I was talking to a colleague about this the other day, some people get very, very angry when they have children and their parents – who are now grandparents act completely differently toward their grandchildren than they did to them when they were, and they're so angry, like, who's this guy who's so loving and I love you, and this is partly it, actually, right? So as a parent with your kids, you're on the, I gotta set them up for 30 years of you know, success and all this stuff, and as a grandparent, you've shifted your mindset in general to, no, we should be here in the moment right now and enjoy what's
Linda, that was a great call. Thank you. But is it as simple as the 30-something knows I've got to lots of time to make up for this current unhappiness. And the 68-year-old says, I don't have as much time as this 30-something, so I do have to live in the moment. I mean, that's
not quite, because there's a lot of 30-year-olds that already have the belief that, you know what, not everything should be about 30 years from now. And there's a lot of, you probably know some of them, old people who still seem to be not able to enjoy themselves in the moment. So I think the age thing matters, but I think it is a bit of a mindset thing. Even
we don't call them old people. We call them older people is what we call it, Michael, okay?
Stephen just emailed and said, now versus later, he says, I really enjoy voting, but then when I look back on it... And then vis-a-vis the marathon you just spoke about, this is from Carla, who says, this is so true. She says she ran the Boston Marathon this year, and remember it was pouring rain.
Oh,
the weather
sure,
was
horrible.
Terrible.
Yeah.
And the experience was horrible. But when she looks, even though it was tough, she looks back on it with fun. It's a badge of honor to have endured that weather with my fellow runners. And no one remembers races in nice weather as fondly. That could be a good point, because it was. Remember, it was pouring and cold. And
I have a theory in life that you should hope for things to go either really, really well or really, really badly.
Why is that?
Because everything in the middle you just forget about. So like a vacation that's like, you know, the weather's fine, there's no travel problems. You can't even remember it, you know. But the amazing things are great. It's the bad things where you're like, oh my god. Remember that bedspread on that bed? It was like, you know, you have these very vivid memories of these bad things that happened to you, and they make for better stories about
who
you are later.
So let's
on.
Be clear. If you're on a vacation, it's only so-so. Do you say to yourself, God, I really hope this makes a horrible turn for the worse?
Definitely.
So that I can really...
If the ceiling hasn't collapsed, collapse it yourself.
Melinda, you're in Boston with Harvard Business School's Michael Norton. We're talking about experienced happiness, meaning in the moment, versus remembered happiness, which I guess is pretty obvious. Hi, Melinda.
Hi, I'm her Melinda.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hi.
Sorry. This last 2 years, I was working two jobs, and I had to sacrifice working out every day. I've lost weight previously, but working the two jobs, I've gained a lot of weight in order to pay off my student loans. So I'm happy to say that I paid off my student loans in January this year. And the lack of sleep, the loss of sleep, and the weight gain is worth it after working so hard to pay off my student loans.
Are you conscious of that when it's happening, by the way, that you're willing to suffer the pain, for lack of a better expression, in the short term because of the long-term happiness? Are you conscious of that as it's happening?
I had to make a decision. I was intent on going through that suffering in order to be relieved of it, because I lived at home. I'm in my 30s, and I still lived in my parents' house, and I had to make that, you know, final decision to pay it off in order to move out. So I was conscious.
What's your reaction to that there, Michael?
Thanks. That was a great
one. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think that's it's a good description of life, actually, you know, that I think we have these goals that we would love to do right now, and they would make us feel really good. The fact that exercise is one of yours is confusing to me, but some people do enjoy exercise. But the idea that you're trading off being happy right now for this really impressive, I mean, paying off your student loans is enormously hard and impressive. So I think it's a testament, actually, to making these decisions, how hard it can be.
Beth in New Hampshire.
I'm sorry. Hi, Beth.
Hi, nice to talk to you again.
You too.
So, like 10 years ago, we had this horrible ice storm. And we lost power at my house for 10 days.
Oh.
And it was an absolutely horrible experience in every way. You know, we had no heat. We had no way to cook, no way to shower, no way to flush toilets.
Love that.
Everyone just pictured a toilet. That's the saddest thing about
everybody.
Go ahead, Beth.
And I remember, like, wanting to have a nervous breakdown when they told me, you know, it was going to be 3 more days. But at the same time, there was one neighbor who had a generator, and like 20 of us were getting together at night, and we were cooking meals together, and the kids were getting together to have a study hall because it was right before midterm exams, and we would all go over in our pajamas and take turns showering. And I look back on it as this like incredible bonding experience with the neighbors and how much fun we had, and And I just know that that was not my reality at all.
So before Michael reacts to that, Beth, if you had the same current event nightmare next month where all the power went off, couldn't use the toilets, couldn't use whatever, would you be able to say to yourself, this is absolutely horrible, but I'm guessing that the payoff down the line is going to be so immense that I'm going to deal with it better than I did the first time?
You know, that's a really good question, because we've lost our power for numerous days the last 3 years. And each time I still have that nervous breakdown again, like I'm never going to make it through this. This is horrible. And then I try and remember, like, we made it through this before and it wasn't so bad. And, you know, in the end, all these good things happen. But in the moment, no, I'm still not very good at it.
So what do you think, Michael Norton?
Yeah, it's, I mean, that's an amazing experience, number one. And I think many people have experiences like that, where it's the negative things that bond you together. And yet none of us then go out and cut our power for 10 days.
All right, exactly.
So
Beth, do you ever go over to your neighbors, even when everything's good, do you ever go over to your neighbors in your pajamas and take a shower there anyway, just for old times or what?
You know, funny, I haven't.
Yeah. Beth, that was a great call, actually. Thank you very much. That was really good. 877-301-8970. Is there a I mean, every time you do this odd research of yours, we're not done yet, so this is not a sign off.
What we're doing again.
Yeah, what we're doing is, Michael, well, why don't you explain what you
don't know?
You're the researcher.
Well, we're talking about experiencing happiness in the moment and looking back at it. And how we may and remembered happiness and how it may be different, or is Beth just called experience this terrible thing in the moment and then looking back and thinking, wow, that was great. I knew my neighbors. We all bonded. We all ran around in our pajamas to each other's houses.
So exactly.
Exactly.
So let's talk about that a little later. So is there a takeaway from this, though, or is this just observational? Usually there's a moral to your stories. Is there a moral to this one or no?
I don't think I've ever had a moral.
Oh, well, I think you have.
But I do think that – so there's no right answer, right? So I think it's not as though you should always live in the moment, and it's not as though you should always, you know, live for looking back on your life. But I think the thing that Cassie and I were interested in is – are we too far one way or the other? So we definitely want to enjoy ourselves every day, you know, whatever that means to us. And we definitely want to, when we are older, look back and say, I'm really glad I did these things. And some of them line up and some of them don't. And so you have to be making decisions that, God, this is really horrible to go for a run every morning, to run this marathon or have a child or whatever else it might be. But you want to make some of those decisions at least so that later on you look back and say, I'm really glad I did those. They were meaningful and important.
We're talking to Michael Norton from Harvard Business School. Tim from Auburn, you're on Boston Public Radio. Thank you much for calling. Hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Excellent. What's going on with you?
Oh, good. So Michael Norton, I believe his name is.
Yeah.
Yes.
A theory about you want things to go really well or really bad because everything else you forget. And I totally agree with that. 3 years ago at this time, I went to Europe with a friend for 3 weeks. And I remember, you know, all the great things that happened there. And I remember getting pickpocketed, my phone stolen and stuff. But all the day stuff in between, that stuff, it's pretty much left my mind after 3 years. So I just really wanted to confirm his theory and kind of agree with it.
But what do you do, both Tim and Michael, what do you do with that? I mean, I was being facetious before. Do you say, I really hope things take a turn for the worst? What do you do with that? Now we have two people confirming the same reality. What do you do with that?
Well, one is if you get caught for stealing, you could say, I was just trying to help. I mean, I listened to a Harvard professor told me that it would be. I think so again, we don't usually choose let's cut the power. I forget which caller it was, but she made the lovely point. It was the older woman who called and made us all want to cry.
I know. She was great.
She talked about how even when the bad things come now, she thinks about them as, these are bad things, but I will get through them, and also maybe these are things that later on. And I think that's the way to approach it, which is that even when the things are bad right now, you just got your wallet stolen and you could ruin your trip, or you could say, wow, that was really bad, but there's some humor in it, and maybe later on it'll be funny, way later on that, you know, this happened to me.
Tim, are you on the same wavelength, or are you still upset about the pickpocket?
Oh, I'm definitely on the same wavelength. I mean, at the time, actually, a girl had gotten her phone stolen. I was trying to help her, and in that process, I got my phone stolen. And,
then you both put your pajamas on, went over to your friend. In any case, Tim, thank you very much for your call. Oh, I'm sorry. Were you mid-sentence there?
Oh, I was just going to say, I was just going to, never mind.
Well, Tim, thank you for your call. We have time for one more,
I think, Marjorie. Then later on probably it turned out that that girl was all part of the racket, and she pretended she lost her phone to distract him so they could steal her phone.
You know, Jasmine just brought a classic one you hear a lot. When someone is mom or dad or someone close to you is dying, and they're, in this case, it was her dad who's in hospice for 3 weeks. And in the moment, the experience was horrible. But looking back, she says, I'm so happy and grateful for the memories. Even when he was sick, I'm glad I can look at those memories positively rather than with overwhelming sadness. You hear that a lot where people say that as awful as it was, in retrospect, it was fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Alex here in Providence, you're going to finish things off for us. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent, thank you.
So I've been thinking about this a lot lately, especially because it's 2018 and everyone's kind of really sucked into their technology. And I've noticed on trips and going out to dinner and whatnot with friends, a lot of people are really focused on capturing the moment on their camera. And I don't know if that brings them any joy later, but it brings me like a great deal of kind of stress because I'd rather be enjoying the moment with the friends as it's happening.
Yeah.
So it does bother me how much I think people need to kind of see themselves enjoying the moment. But when they were actually there, it wasn't, you know, it's just kind of a perceived thing.
By the way, I love this phone call. I am so in the same place that Alex is. So many, I think people don't experience, I don't know if this fits into this research, that moment, because they're just trying to memorialize the moment rather than live the moment. That's where you're going, Alex, yes?
When you watch these people, like, you know, posing and making faces, and it just seems so fake. You know, and it doesn't even look like them. You know, you see people, they make these expressions, and then you see them on camera, you know, like making a kissy face or whatever. And it just, you know, it doesn't really ring true for me.
We got it, Alex. Thanks. So what's your reaction?
I can tell, Alex, that you're thinking of like two specific friends who do this that drive you crazy. But we won't ask their names. Yeah, I think, and again, it is this tension, right? So my father actually recently, so he used to always make us take pictures on vacation. For the younger listeners, this used to involve like a camera with film.
Right.
And you couldn't just take 1,000 pictures because you only had some film. So you had to like pose and all this stuff, try to get it right. And only my father's 81. And only recently he said, you know, I didn't enjoy that. I was doing it for you so that you'd have pictures later. He said, do you think I enjoyed corralling 5 children into pictures when I just wanted to have fun? So I think there is some trade-off between – you do want the evidence of the memory.
Yeah, you
but
do.
But when it starts to get in the way of even enjoying the experience at all, well, now you're maybe on the wrong side of this tension that we've been talking about.
Michael, it's great to see you.
Thank you.
Congratulations
to you
and your colleague
They're
again.
Always great ones.
They are great
Michael
ones.
Michael Norton is the Harold Brierley Professor of Business Administration at Harvard Business School. His latest book is Happy Money, The Science of Happier Spending. Thank you very much, Michael. Coming up. Just in time for fall, it's Squirrel NATO. Naturalist Cy Montgomery is here to talk about the booming population of the bushy-tailed critters. She joins for that and much more from the Animal Kingdom next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. What is this? Oh, it's afternoon, another edition of the Afternoon Zoo. It's good you're really organized here, Jim. It's a look at the intersection of human behavior, that'd be mine, and animal behavior. Leading the way is the great Cy Montgomery. Cy, as you know, is a journalist, naturalist, and a BPR contributor. I finally got to you, Cy. Good to talk to you. How are you?
I'm great. How are you, Jim?
Excellent.
Great to talk to you. Well, let's start with this fascinating story about goats that can seem to recognize smiles and not smiles and faces. What's up with that?
Don't you love this?
I love this story.
This is fantastic. This was the results of a study at Queen Mary University in London, and they took 20 goats, and they showed them black and white images of human faces, and some of them were smiling, and others were scowling and looking angry. And they found that the goats spent far more time approaching the happy, smiling faces than the angry faces, which means they can interpret our emotions by looking at our faces. And I just love this. I think this is so great. There had been an earlier study, which was done at Cambridge University, that showed that goats can recognize President Obama.
What does that mean?
They recognize individual faces. They trained them to recognize former President Obama, a British newscaster, and two actors. And they could pick those people out by photographs and tell who they were versus other people who were strangers. So they recognize our faces. So when you look into the face of a goat and you're like, oh, I'm not sure if this is goat A or goat B, the goat probably can tell you apart from some other face.
You know, Simon Montgomery, as someone who doesn't have your level of expertise, I'm less amazed by the ability to differentiate one person from another than to be able to differentiate one facial expression from another on the same person. And my dogs can do this. Am I right about this? The dogs are one animal that can. Are dogs?
Have you seen dogs trying to smile back at you?
Well, I don't know. I mean, sometimes I think that, but you believe
they do. They do, and it's like a great thing. You should go on the internet and look for images of dogs who are trying to mimic what they think we look like, and they pull their lips back from their teeth, but they don't look like they're snarling. They look like they're trying to be a person smiling.
But why does a goat, or if I'm right, the dogs are in the same boat, they not only can recognize different facial expressions, but they prefer a smile. Why do they prefer a smile? Do they know that what goes with it, that happiness and good treatment is more likely to connect to a smile, or is it is that what it is?
I feel certain that's it, because these goats, these 20 goats that they got for this study, they came from Buttercup Sanctuary in southeast England, and these goats had been there for a year eating dried pasta and getting cuddles from people. They knew what a smile meant.
I'm looking at hysterical pictures online of dogs smiling right now.
Are you?
It's great, Marjorie.
Oh,
my gosh.
It's great. And by the way, besides dogs, what other animals can recognize, and goats, what other animals can do this?
Well, horses can. Horses. We know that.
Wow.
Interestingly, there's probably a lot more animals that do recognize facial expressions than we realize. But interestingly, our cousins, chimpanzees, if you smile and show your teeth at a chimp, the chimp will be totally offended and upset. Because in chimp world, when you peel your lips away from your teeth, that's a fear grin. It's a fear grin, and it means something bad is about to happen. So you never want to smile broadly like that at a chimp, and they'll misinterpret it.
Well, let's go from smiling goats to killer goats. Apparently, there's these goats, mountain goats, in Olympic National Park in Washington State that are overrunning the park, and one of them gored a human being to death. Oh my God.
It's awful.
Yeah.
But listen, this is why this happened. I mean, again, people, not the goats, are at fault. These goats at Olympic National Park in Washington State, they were introduced in the 1920s. Because people thought that they needed to have goats in the national park. I don't know why. And the goats love salt. A lot of ungulates love salt. So they're attracted to trails. Why are they attracted to trails? Because people pee there, and there's salt in it. So they encounter when the goats are on the trails, people walking along the trails. And then people start to feed the goats. Well, then the goats feel like, oh, there's a person. Wait a minute. Where's my food? Where's my delicious salty palm? And although I don't know the exact circumstances of this death in 2010, probably the goat was just a little bit insistent. The person didn't know what the goat wanted. The goat got upset, and this death ensued. So what they're doing now, there's now 725 or something mountain goats in this place that didn't have them before. They're there because we put them there. And so now the Parks Department, on Tuesday, they started helicoptering out these goats to a region that needed more goats, the Northern Cascade Mountain Range. And can you imagine, though, looking
No.
And seeing
them,
these
little
these
dangling
goats with
hooves, yeah. I should say.
Right, with these little blue blindfolds on and their little orange jackets soaring by, dangling by a string from a helicopter. That's got to be a sight.
Yeah, so is this okay? I mean, they also said that they were going to relocate about half of them and shoot the rest of them, which seemed a little nasty. Why don't they just relocate them all?
I think they're feeling like when they're not going to find them all. I mean, what they were hoping, even with shooting them, they were hoping to just get the population down to, 10% of what it was. I don't think they feel they can get them all. And, of course, it's not fair to the mountain goats because they did not ask to be transferred there. It's all because of what we did. But, as usual, it's the animals that have to pay the price.
But they should be okay once they're relocated, or are they going to be too traumatized?
Well, I bet they're confused. I mean, happily, they were tranked before they went flying.
Yeah.
I mean, I kind of wish every time I go on a plane, I could get tranked,
too. Yeah, me too.
At least I'm not dangling on a string by a helicopter.
How would you feel, Marty, if you're walking in Coolidge Corner and all of a sudden you're lifted up and taken to Acton and plopped down in Acton? How would you feel?
I would be upset.
You know, before we leave, I'm sorry. I'm obsessing on this smile thing. I hate going backwards in these discussions, but I just did what Marjorie did a second ago and looked at dogs smiling. Is there, other than the fact that this whole goat thing and dogs doing it and horses is charming, I guess, I hate the word charming, but is endearing, is there a greater significance to this? I mean, you are as intensely into the interspecies relationships we have with non-human animals. Is there a takeaway from the fact that they can recognize our facial expressions, or is it just what it is, if you know what I mean, Si?
Yeah, I totally know what you mean. I think the takeaway is that many animals are incredibly sensitive to us and watch us in a really careful way. And that suggests that we're capable of watching them just as carefully. And maybe we should, because if we're going to interact with the natural world, with all these other wonderful species with whom we share the planet, I love the fact that without any official many animals can observe us in this way, and we can do it too. I mean, when I was interacting with the octopuses that I've known at New England Aquarium, I mean, here's this alien being that could figure out that it was me and not someone else opening that tank, and would greet me and was happy to see me. And to tell you the truth, you know, because octopuses can change color and shape in a second, I mean, I knew who was in that tank because that was the octopus that was in the tank. But in the open ocean, would I have recognized my friend Octavia, who I knew for 2 years? I probably wouldn't have recognized her, but I think she would recognize me.
By the way, if you don't know, Si's spectacular book on what she was describing and much more is called The Soul of an Octopus. And if you haven't read it, you really are in for a huge treat.
Simon, it is a terrific book, actually. It's in the pictures. Si, we read about these seagulls in Rome, and I wondered if what happens there can happen there. I guess they don't have a lot of screens and stuff, so people have open windows. And this woman had this in Sicily. She was in Rome. She grew up in Sicily. She had this seagull that was in her kitchen eating up the garbage in the garbage can. And when she threw a couple of slippers at her, the seagull charged, and she had to go flying out of the kitchen with her poor cat cowering in the corner.
Her cat then peed on the couch.
Yeah.
It was really a disaster.
So I guess the moral of the story is that if the seagulls here come after our French fries, we should just let the seagull have it and not fight back.
Which they do.
Well, here's what they should do. I mean, guess why the seagulls are there 20 miles from the ocean?
I don't know.
They're there because Rome hosted Europe's largest open dump until it was closed in 2013.
Oh.
And there's garbage all over the streets. And so word spread in the seagull community. And we know that birds spread information to other birds. We know this from studies of crows, for example. And so the next thing you knew, the gulls showed up to eat all of this free food. And then they noticed, hey, there's someone walking down the street eating some French fries. I think I'll have a bite. And then the other thing that is really kind of sad but also somewhat hilarious, they eat starlings and pigeons who are found in cities too. And you know how the Pope releases peace doves?
Sure.
Yes.
Well, one day he released some peace doves and a seagull saw this happen and instantly creamed the poor dove, tore it to shreds.
Oh.
So, you know, people are kind of upset about this. By the way, peace doves are essentially doves and pigeons are the same thing. Not all doves are pigeons, but all pigeons are a kind of dove. But anyway, yeah, if Rome would clean up its trash, the seagulls would go away.
So can we leave Rome in the rearview mirror and come back to New England for the next couple of stories? I was under the impression, not that the turtles are my area of expertise, that hatching time was springtime. But yeah. But it's not, right? There's a ton of hatching of native baby turtles going on as we speak. Am I right about that? Or?
Yes, and people don't realize this because we always think, like you do quite reasonably, that spring is the time for new life. But particularly snappers, most of them are hatching now. And some of our endangered turtles, like wood turtles and Blanding's turtles, they're hatching now too.
Is this a climate change thing, or is this a normal thing that's going on?
No, this is normal.
Normal,
yeah,
okay.
This is normal. So you might see these little, you know, less than silver dollar sized infant turtles trying to walk across the street or even in your yard.
And squirrels, we understand, are on a huge population surge, despite the troubles for the turtles. Oh, by the way, you have a story about a little girl.
Oh, this Heidi Bell.
The kid
is,
I almost forgot. A little girl named Heidi. Yes. What's her deal? Tell us about what she's been up to.
Oh, this kid is so great. She lives in Peterborough, and I met her when I spoke at her school, and she's 10. And she loves turtles. So she decided one day that she was going to raise some money to give to the turtle rehabilitation project at New England Aquarium. Every year at New England Aquarium, there's all these cold, stunned sea turtles who need our help, and they're taken back to the aquarium, and the veterinary staff takes care of them, and then they are released when they're well. Well, this person, this child, made beautiful bags that you can carry your groceries in. She made gorgeous jewelry. She made she bought some reusable straws. She made other artwork, and she sold these one day in front of a store in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and raised almost $600.
Good for her.
I was so great, and so we went in a little while ago to New England Aquarium to hand the check to the head veterinarian, Dr. Charlie Innes. And she got to meet and hand feed Myrtle, the most famous turtle. She's over 80 years old, 550-pound green sea turtle who rules the giant ocean tank.
What a great kid. That's a terrific story. We're talking to Cy Montgomery about animals, of course, her area of expertise. So, Cy, get back to the squirrels. Apparently their population is surging. But should we be worried about this? I don't mind the squirrels on the porch. I mean, is there a problem?
Yeah, I don't mind either. But my friend at New Hampshire Fish and Game calls a year like this squirrel NATO because you're trying to drive down the street and two or three squirrels are going to do these kamikaze missions right under your wheels. And it's so upsetting. But it's because last year's acorn crop was huge. And as you probably know, some years there's a whole lot of acorns. This doesn't happen every year or even every other year that we get a monster crop, but we got a monster crop, and the babies today are all trying to find a place to live. They're now adolescents, and they're trying to find a new place to be, so they're running across the street. They're swimming. People are seeing them swimming in lakes and ponds and across rivers. They are all over the place. But this is a natural thing, and it's nothing for us to worry about, but do watch it on the roads. It's so hard because they'll run out.
They do.
And sometimes they'll stand there like a deer in the headlights, and you don't know what to do. Do you swerve to the right? Do you swerve to the left? Is the squirrel going to run back where he came from? You kind of wish they'd keep going. I honk at them and hope that that makes them keep going. And generally, I have found that they keep going in the direction that they were going if you honk at them instead of turn around and run back. But that's just my experience.
You know, we should end with Cy Montgomery with another, I don't know if this is interspecies, like with goats and humans, but it's inter something. Do you see this great story about in Canada that this narwhal, I think for the last, and those are the ones with little horns coming out of their heads or whatever, the huge horns coming out of their heads, has been hanging out, for lack of a better expression, with a pod, if that's the correct line, of belugas. And how unusual, first of all, do you know about it? And two, is it, how unusual is that kind of relationship, for lack, I guess, of a better expression?
Well, there are a lot of interspecies relationships. And interestingly, even though narwhals, with their long spiraling tusk that can get 10 feet long,
well, I didn't know that.
They look very different from the all-white beluga whale.
Of course, yeah.
They actually are close relatives.
Oh.
They're very similar to one another. And they both species like to travel in large groups. And so this guy, he's a male who obviously got separated from his group. He's just seeking the company of some other whales. And this pod, he's like broing out with this other pod of belugas. What I find particularly odd is, you know, he's more than 600 miles south of his normal range. And even having belugas in the St. Lawrence, that's pretty south of their range. And this is all about climate change. Mm-hmm. Belugas have been seen as far south as New Jersey.
You know, speaking of a fish that we didn't usually see as much around here, we only have about 40 seconds left, Cy, but very quickly, any ideas about how people should coexist with the sharks, which seem to be all over the place now in Cape Cod?
Well, we can stay on the land and have a perfectly good life, eating delicious food, traveling where we need to, finding our mates. But they have to be in the water.
Yeah. So we should stay out of the water entirely, or maybe just only go out 2 or 3 feet?
Well, here's what I think. I mean, I'm a scuba diver, and when you do sports like that, you know you're taking a risk.
Yeah.
Something can happen to you. It's probably not going to happen. Nothing's probably going to happen. You are far more likely, despite this terrible death of a super guy, apparently. I feel so bad.
He does sound great, the revered guy.
Arthur Medici, 26.
That's so sad. But, you know, you are far more likely to be injured or killed driving to the beach than swimming in the ocean.
Okay, Cy Montgomery.
80 years.
I love to talk to you.
Great
Thank you so
as
much.
Always.
I so appreciate your time.
You
Great.
Guys.
I love talking to you. I learned so much. Cy, thank you. Cy joins us every month for the Afternoon Zoo. She's a journalist, naturalist, and a BPR contributor. Her latest book, and it's terrific, How to Be a Good Creature, a Memoir in 13 Animals. And thanks again to Cy Montgomery. Thanks to you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can always find us by way of our podcast on iTunes. Tune in tomorrow for WGBH Executive Arts Editor Jared Bowen, Andrew Cabral. Mark Leibovich is here to talk about his new book about the NFL and Tom Brady. We want to tell you on Friday at the library, we're going to be joined by historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. She's got a new book. I want to thank our crew.
Well, and somebody else is joining us at 1 o'clock on Friday.
Is Ethan Hawke going to come?
Ethan Hawke is going to be with us
great actor,
live
Ethan Hawke.
At the library.
So hubba hubba. Get yourselves down
hubba,
to the
hubba.
Boston Public
Who
Library.
Who says hubba hubba
I do.
2018?
I do. Our crew, we want to thank Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Teresky, Arjun Singh, and our engineer, John the Claw Parker. Ethan Hawke. Okay, what's going on, Jim? On
Ethan
TV?
Hawke. Hubba
well,
hubba,
he's pretty,
as Marjorie
he's,
said.
Oh, he's kind of cute, and he's a great actor.
I think he's great. He's also directing. That's one of the reasons he's coming to see us. Well, he's coming to see a number of people. We're going to talk more about the Kavanaugh thing, the latest updates. We're going to talk about YIMBYism, not NIMBYism, but people who want new development in their neighborhoods. Rather odd. We'll talk to you about what the problems are there. Adam Riley's got a package, and David Paleologos, pollster extraordinaire, has the latest on some pretty important races in Massachusetts. Governor United States Senate, ballot questions. He's going to give us the latest polling numbers, brand new, hot off the presses, and what that means for Election Day, less than 50 days away. Do you know that Ethan Hawke's going to be with us on Friday?
He's going to be with us on Friday. Doris Kearns Goodman and Ethan Hawke. Doesn't get much better than that, except for you and I, Jim, of course.
We'll be there.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thanks for listening. Please tune again tomorrow.